Welcome, everybody, and if folks could get your seats, we are welcoming both the Health and Human Services Policy and Finance Committee together to hear a presentation by the Legislative Auditor on MNsure. And we are going to have presentations from our Legislative Auditor regarding the report which was released today at 11 o'clock, and we're going to move through that, and then we will have time for questions. We'll also have CEO of MNsure, Scott Leitz, will be here as well to answer questions, and folks from the department, Commissioner Jessen, will also be available for members' questions. Members should have the report delivered to you. If you don't have that from your packet, please just let one of the staff know, and we'll make sure that everyone has that available to them. With that, our meeting is called to order, and if Mr. Nobles, if you would like to proceed, welcome to our committee. Thank you for your work on this report, and please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jim Nobles. I'm the Legislative Auditor, and with me at the table is Joel Alter, who is the manager of our evaluation of MNsure. Mr. Chairman and members of the Joint Committee, judgments about MNsure and the Affordable Care Act often reflect a person's philosophical position or political affiliation. As a nonpartisan audit and evaluation office, the Office of the Legislative Auditor does not have a position on whether the ACA is good or bad. Nor do we have a position on whether the state of Minnesota should have created its own health insurance exchange. We do, however, have a position on how well MNsure performed in its first year of operations. We think MNsure performed poorly. That is a hard statement for me to make because I know and I see in this room many dedicated state employees who worked long hours over many, many months to make MNsure a success. But despite that hard work and despite the fact that we spent tens of millions of dollars to create MNsure, MNsure did not deliver what was promised. MNsure said that on October 1, 2013, it would open for business and provide the people of Minnesota with an easy, seamless way to shop, compare, and purchase a private health insurance plan or become eligible for a public health program. MNsure fell far short of that promise. MNsure did not provide a good shopping experience for many people who needed insurance and who tried to obtain it through MNsure. Far too many people struggled in frustration for hours trying to navigate through MNsure's website and then spent longer time waiting to get help from the MNsure call center. In addition, MNsure did not provide the Minnesota Department of Human Services with a reliable mechanism for determining whether people are eligible for the state's public health care programs. Having a modernized, fully integrated electronic eligibility determination system was a key reason the state decided to create MNsure. MNsure was supposed to give us what we failed to get from HealthMatch. MNsure got us a little closer, but it did not provide DHS and the state with what is needed, and that is a fully functioning, fully reliable eligibility determination system. As a result, many eligibility determinations had to be processed the old-fashioned way by county workers. So again, on the question of MNsure's performance in its first year of operations, we conclude MNsure did not deliver what was promised, what was expected, and what was needed. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to turn to Mr. Alter to tell you why we ended up in that position. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nobles. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
My name is Joel Alter with the Legislative Auditor's Office, and I was the project manager. And I also want to acknowledge Ryan Maltz and Laura Schwartz, who assisted with this evaluation. When we were asked by the Legislative Audit Commission to take a look at MNsure I think everyone knew it had been a rough first year, and there had been a lot of negative publicity. We did everything that we could in approaching this evaluation not to make any presumptions. And so we talked with as many people as we could to get firsthand knowledge. We looked at as much data as we could. We went to considerable effort to do some surveying of consumers, of people who help consumers, and a variety of other things. Mostly, as Mr. Noble said, we focused on that first year of MNsure's experience, not the second enrollment period, which is just now concluding. And as Mr. Noble's already summarized, let me just state kind of our overall conclusions and then get into a little bit of background. And we concluded that MNsure's failures in that first year of enrollment outweighed its achievements. Yes, there were many people who enrolled through MNsure, and we found that many people were quite pleased with the products that were available through MNsure. But the problems, getting stuck in the technology, waiting on hold, encountering a system that was not as simple as promised, was just not acceptable. And as we'll discuss, we think the legislature should find ways to establish clearer lines of authority and accountability for MNsure, both the agency as well as the enrollment system that it has helped develop. MNsure is a health insurance exchange, and I want to start with just a little bit of background about exchanges. Exchanges, or as they're sometimes called, marketplaces, were established by the Affordable Care Act. An exchange is simply intended to simplify the process of buying insurance. It can enable consumers to make comparisons of products, things like what the products cover, the deductibles, the premiums, which doctors I can use. States had some options about exchanges. States could develop their own exchanges. They could work in partnership with the federal government to establish an exchange, or they could rely entirely on the federal government's exchange. And this year, Minnesota is one of 13 states, plus the District of Columbia, running state-based exchanges. Most states are using the federal exchange. There are also private health insurance exchanges out there, and some people may say, well, why do we need a state exchange when there are these types of things out there already? The Affordable Care Act authorized tax credits and special subsidies to make insurance more affordable, and the only way to get access to those is by enrolling in insurance through a federally approved exchange. Next, I want to provide a little background on this agency called MNsure that was created by the 2013 legislature. State law defines the agency as a 7-member board appointed by the governor. The board can appoint staff, and the lead administrative staff person is MNsure's CEO. MNsure has a substantial budget in fiscal year 2015, $119 million. That budget is expected to decline in coming years as federal funds gradually dry up. In addition, DHS is paying a substantial amount to MNsure each year for those individuals who enroll through the public programs. MNsure also collects a portion of the premium payments for products that are sold through the exchange. MNsure follows some of the same laws that other state agencies follow, but it was also given some important exemptions. For example, MNsure is allowed to follow an expedited rulemaking process. It's exempt from many of the state's procurement laws. Also, its IT projects aren't required by law to receive the level of oversight from the Office of Minute Services that other agencies' projects would be required to have. And separate from MNsure, the agency, there is this enrollment system that MNsure helped to build. Minnesota has received $189 million in federal funds to build the system. Not all of that has been spent yet. In addition, there are some separate dollars that, both state and federal dollars, that have gone to the Department of Human Services for the purpose of modernizing public program eligibility systems. The MNsure enrollment system can enroll people in either commercial insurance or in public programs like medical assistance. This is unlike the approach in many states. The exchange provides essentially a one-stop shop. And so if you have a family, for example, that has members, some of whom are on public programs and some maybe are looking for private insurance, that family could potentially go to this one place to purchase insurance for all of the family members. The federal and state governments have not delegated responsibility for public program eligibility to MNsure. That still is the responsibility of the Department of Human Services. But DHS's intent has been to rely enormously on the Minsure enrollment system for this purpose. Maybe to no one's surprise, our report confirms that user problems with Minsure were both widespread and serious. And part of the problem always was the amount of time it was going to take to develop a very complex system. Time always seemed to be in short supply. Minsure got off to a late start in getting a federal grant, and it took 3 years to get statutory authorization for the exchange. And let's just look at this graphically on this next slide. The ACA passed in March of 2013. Enrollment through Minsure started in October 2013. So when we look at those initial months, there were 48 states nationally that got their first federal grants to at least explore developing an exchange in September of 2010. At that point, Minnesota was prohibited by an executive order by the governor to pursue federal money to plan for an exchange. That changed when a new governor was elected, and that previous order was overturned. And so Minnesota applied for and received in February of 2011 its first federal grant, but that was about 5 months after the other states had received, most states had received theirs. And as I mentioned, state legislation to authorize the creation of Minsure passed, but not until March of 2013. Again, that was 3 years after the ACA passed. And while there were many things happening during that time to begin building an exchange, there was always some uncertainty until that statute was passed whether or not Minnesota was going to proceed. And certainly without statutory authority, there would have been some questions. In addition, state law said the Minsure Board could not assume its full authority until it had created bylaws and policies. And the dotted line on this next slide, way off to the right, shows the board received that authority only 5 weeks before Minsure went live with this new enrollment system. There were other reasons besides time that Minsure ran into some difficulties. It took exchange officials longer than they expected to select vendors who would build the new IT system. Once the vendors were picked, Minsure had some second thoughts about those vendors and their performance during the early months. Only about 6 months into the contract, Minsure initiated changes in the roles played by the vendors. For many aspects of the exchange, the federal government issued rules that outlined how the exchange had to function. Many of those rules had to be incorporated into the exchange software. Those rules trickled out well into 2013, and that made a tight timeline even more difficult. Some people have asked whether Minsure had a choice to go live on October 1st, 2013. And we had a discussion with federal officials about that. Based on that discussion, I'd say there was maybe a little bit of give in that time room, but not a lot. If a state believed that its technology was in fact not ready to go live October 2013, it would have needed to give the Fed several months of heads up so that the proper connections could have been made to the federal exchange. And I should mention that Minnesota never actually asked for a postponement in beginning a state-based exchange. Exchange officials there were issues besides lack of time. There were some execution issues that I want to focus on next. Exchange officials were reluctant to initially involve the Office of Minute Services in a meaningful way in what was a very complicated IT project. Minute ultimately kind of elbowed its way into this project and did play a meaningful role, but probably not a role equivalent to what it would have played in any other agency's large IT project. A new IT system requires a lot of testing, and that's especially true for systems that are making eligibility determinations for public programs. In the end, there was very little testing done of the Minsure system involving too few scenarios. The test, in many cases, didn't go well, and there was essentially no time to fix many of those problems before the system went live. When you've got multiple vendors, it's always going to be challenging to integrate those vendors and the software that they're developing. Well before even testing occurred, there were some red flags that this project was facing some serious challenges and risks. And these were challenges to scope and schedule and quality control. Generally, the Minsure officials put a pretty good light on things, weren't as straightforward as they should have been to their own board, and to top executive branch officials, and I'll come back to that issue. When Minshew went live, staff recognized that there were unresolved issues. The hope had been that these issues could be fixed once enrollment started, but instead efforts to fix these problems led to more problems. What was the impact of the technical problems? Well, as I'll discuss in a minute, there was enormous consumer frustration. These were not just minor issues, they were big issues, and the number of people affected was large. The Department of Human Services had hoped to migrate all of its pre-Minshew medical assistance and Minnesota Care cases into the Minshew system in 2014. DHS needed to replace its old IT systems where those cases had been handled, and the new Minshew system was to be the new solution. But DHS and the counties lost confidence in the ability of the Minshew system to deliver, and so that migration of those cases kept getting postponed. In the meantime, months passed without any meaningful eligibility determinations. Did that have a cost impact to the state? I'd say almost certainly it did, although it would be difficult to determine that specifically. Meanwhile, counties and insurers struggled because of the limited functionality of the Minshew system. For example, today counties can't determine how many MA cases they have on their caseloads. And when it comes to doing something that you would think is routine, like making a change in a case, let's say a family is on MA, have a new baby, and that case needs to be added to the MA caseload, that now takes about 60 to 90 minutes. In the old, outdated systems, it took about 5 minutes. And likewise, insurers have had their own difficulties. They expected an efficient process for Minshew to transmit information on these new cases to them so that they could send out insurance cards and things like that. In fact, the process has been very manual and time-consuming. I'd like to turn next to a discussion of enrollment that occurred through Minshew during the first open enrollment period. In October 2013, Minshew set a target of enrolling a total of 135,000 people through March of 2014, through that first open enrollment period. And in fact, as we see here, the actual number that enrolled was about 186,000. So at first glance, it looks like that first open enrollment period was a success. And I should mention that of those people who enrolled, about 85% of them were in the public programs. The problem is that 135,000 target was a flawed one. It included a serious error made by DHS. DHS had mistakenly estimated that over the six-month period of open enrollment, only 12,000 people would enroll in MA during that period, which was an unrealistically low estimate. And so if we were to incorporate more realistic numbers, we would have had a larger target that Minshew was shooting for, and Minshew would have fallen short of that target had that target been more realistic. One of the things we did in our evaluation was to look at the characteristics of the people who enrolled during the first year. And this slide focuses on commercial enrollments. And I think it's interesting just to go through a few of the things that we know about the people who enrolled. The age group with the largest number of enrollees, interestingly, is an older group, 55 to 64. Products that are sold through Minshew are put into what are called meta levels. The products are rated by an actuary based on what amount of the what are called the essential health benefits will be covered by that insurance product. So, for example, if you buy a platinum product, which is the highest level, 90% of the essential health benefits would be covered. If you buy a bronze plan, only 60% would be covered. The most common plan sold through Minshew was a silver plan, which covered about 70% of essential health benefits. The most common insurer was Preferred One, with about 60% of the enrollments. And as you know, Preferred One chose not to continue during the second year of enrollment. I'd like to be able to give you some idea of race and ethnicity of the enrollees. There were targets that Minshew adopted for enrollment in different racial and ethnic categories. The questions in the application related to race and ethnicity were voluntary, and generally we found when we tried to look at the data that there were other problems as well. So we simply don't know anything meaningful about racial and ethnic profiles of the enrollees. Of the people who enrolled in commercial insurance, we found that at least 41% received the advanced premium tax credit, and that's used to reduce the cost of a person's premiums. Of the people who selected this tax credit, the median monthly amount of that tax credit was $154. Also, about 13% of the people who enrolled in commercial plans received what was called a cost-sharing reduction. That's basically a reduction in their out-of-pocket costs. And some people received both a tax credit and a cost-sharing reduction as well. So overall, about 50% of the people who enrolled in commercial plans got either a tax credit or a cost-sharing reduction. And finally, we compared the number of enrollees in regions of the state with the number of uninsured in those parts of the state. And from our analysis, it appeared that enrollment was weaker in the northwest and the southwest regions of the state. What was MNsure's impact on the number of uninsured in Minnesota? At this point, there's still a lot that we don't know. We do know from a University of Minnesota study that was done last year that Minnesota's number of uninsured people dropped by 181,000 during a period roughly equivalent to MNsure's first 8 months, and that's good news. Most of that reduction was in the public program part of the insurance market. And there may have been various factors, and that's why it's hard to tease out exactly what drove that. This was a period when the state expanded the Medicaid program. This was a period when the federal mandate for people to have insurance kicked in, and it was a period when MNsure was trying to recruit people into insurance. So probably all of those things played roles. In our survey of people who enrolled in commercial insurance through MNsure, we found that 28% were not insured immediately prior to their MNsure enrollment. Earlier I mentioned the consumer experience and some of the problems that people had. And the experience was certainly not entirely bad, as I'll mention in a moment. But there were certainly plenty of bad to go along with the good. And let me start on the negative side. The enrollment process was long and complex for many people. Among the people who enrolled in a commercial plan that we surveyed, when you look at the time that they spent online with an in-person assister, if they used one, or that they spent on the phone with MNsure, the average amount that they reported was for 4 hours. 75% of users that we surveyed reported having significant technical problems with the website. Navigators and brokers who helped those consumers also reported very common problems, technical problems. Some of the application questions were difficult to understand. I'm not going to go through some examples, but on page 85 of the report, there's an exhibit that kind of shows some of the things on the application that we thought could have tripped people up. There were serious problems with the notifications of consumers about their applications. For example, for 6 months during 2014, MNsure applicants did not receive notification of their eligibility for tax credits after they had applied. And for 6 months, people who were trying to enroll in public programs, but who had what was called a pending application because it wasn't complete, were not notified of that. Serious problems with notifications. On the positive side, what we found was more satisfaction than dissatisfaction with the products people purchased through MNsure. 67% said they would purchase the same product again. Of course, many purchased through Preferred One and didn't have that opportunity in the second enrollment period. We also found that 43% said that the insurance that they bought through MNsure lowered their health insurance costs. 26% said their insurance costs went up. The other positive, I think, was just that the MNsure site provided an opportunity to shop and compare. And while, again, that did exist elsewhere, you generally didn't have any other place where you could shop and compare or investigate both public and commercial insurance, and where you had the option of looking into tax credits. We looked in depth at the experience of users with MNsure's call center during the first year, and our conclusion was that customer service was inadequate. Many people had to wait very long times when they called MNsure's helplines. Over the course of the first year, about one-third of calls were abandoned. There were high abandonment rates during open enrollment, and then again during the summer months. Insurer's goal had been that no more than 5% of calls be abandoned. A lot of the problems had to do with staffing. Insurer didn't have enough of its own staff in the call center to handle the volume of calls. They didn't enter into a contract to have a backup set of call center staff until February 2014, less than 2 months before the end of open enrollment. For the second open enrollment period, Minsure added a lot of call center staff and did have a backup vendor to help with calls. We also asked consumers, navigators, brokers about the quality of information that they received from the call center, and we heard a lot of concerns. And Minsure conceded that the hiring and the training process during that first year was rushed. And so you had people who sometimes got conflicting information, depending on who they talked with. They couldn't get answers to the technical questions that they were running into, and there was weak coordination between the Minsure call center and some of the other call centers that people would be referred to. To help people through the process, Minsure had a network of assisters. These people were certified by Minsure to help people enroll, and they received training for that purpose. Some of these assisters were what are called navigators. They typically work for community organizations. They receive payments from the state when they enroll people through Minsure. You had others who were brokers, that is insurance brokers, who could be paid by insurers when they help people enroll in commercial insurance. There was another group called certified application counselors, usually with hospitals and clinics, and they received no compensation, special compensation for the people that they helped to enroll. Minsure provided about $5 million in grants to organizations that employed navigators. During the first year, Minsure did relatively little oversight of those grantee activities, and grantees were not held accountable for the enrollment targets that were in their contracts. We think the roles of the assisters were not as clear as they should have been. That resulted in some people getting referred back and forth, and they'd go to a navigator and might end up getting referred to a broker to help them make a decision about a product. Likewise, some people started with a broker and got referred back to a navigator. And brokers helped many consumers for whom they received no compensation. Some brokers were unaware that they had to be appointed with a particular insurer. It wasn't enough just to be certified by Minsure to be to provide assistance to consumers. They had to be appointed with each insurer if they were going to be compensated by each of those insurers. Also, brokers generally received no compensation when they helped people enroll in public programs. And so what we had is a lot of brokers who didn't come back for the second year of enrollment. If there's a feeling that there are too few brokers, we put forth a couple of options. One is something that some other states have done called universal appointment, where if you get certified by the exchange, you would be able to be compensated by any of the insurers that do business through the exchange. And another option would be to compensate brokers for individuals who enroll in public programs. Actually, Minnesota law allows for that, but it is not a widely publicized provision. The next slides, I want to just say some things about governance. First, I mentioned that Minsure is governed by a 7-member board. It's not normal to have a major state agency with a governing board, but there are cases. The Pollution Control Agency or Public Utilities Commission are examples. And again, as I said before, the Minsure board didn't receive its full authority until just weeks before the enrollment system went live. So, in our view, it's hard to place much blame on this board because they simply weren't very much a part of the development of that system. The board was developing policies during those early months as required by statute. We found that regarding those policies, not all of them have been followed through on. There have been policies requiring monthly and quarterly financial reporting. Generally hasn't happened. Policies requiring development of targets, goals for the organization related to things like affordability and accessibility, and those have been developed. Regarding Minsure administration, we observed that there is not the direct connection. The Minsure Board hires the CEO of Minsure, but there is not direct accountability to elected officials. During 2013, when Minsure was racing to get the exchange started, administrative leadership, as I mentioned earlier, was not very forthcoming with others about kind of the status of things. Even when the board asked some pretty detailed questions, there were not always detailed answers. And others in the administration, including the governor, were not told until late in the process the significant challenges that Minsure was facing. As Jim mentioned, there has been a lot of hard work by staff to get the exchange built. But I think there was also a fundamental miscalculation of how difficult this process was going to be. And administrative officials within Minsure set high expectations, and we think they bear some responsibility that the exchange didn't live up to those expectations. And what about the governance of not just Minsure, but the enrollment system that Minsure helped to build? Who decides what the priorities are for that system? Minsure and DHS both rely a lot on that system to enroll individuals in commercial insurance and public programs. The Office of Minute Services has to maintain that system going forward, even though it was built by private vendors. There was, during part of 2013, a governance structure for that system. It kind of dissolved when the technical problems began to arise later in 2013. And then in late 2014, Minute, DHS, Minsure again tried to come up with a governance structure for this enrollment system. You'll sometimes hear references to the Executive Steering Committee or the Change Control Board, which are bodies that they created late in 2014. But there are no laws, there are no policies, interagency agreements that establish that structure. It's very informal. And DHS in particular expressed concern to us about the informality of that process and would prefer greater clarity about the roles of the various players. And I think about the composition, about the structure. Our recommendations to the legislature in this report are largely directed at the governance issue. We recommend amending state law so that the governor, rather than the Minsure board, appoints the Minsure CEO. Again, this would provide a more direct line of accountability in a program that is certainly visible and needs to be more directly accountable. If the Minsure CEO is a governor appointee, I think it'd be reasonable to ask what role, if any, the board should continue to play in the future. Should it be, if it continues to exist, a governing board or an advisory board? Those are questions that we discuss in the report, but we don't make a recommendation. We think there's room for discussion about that. And again, it's become clear to us that there's a need for greater clarity in how the IT system that's been developed should be governed. At a minimum, there needs to be clarity in law about that structure, and in doing so, we think the legislature should give careful consideration to the composition of that governance structure. And finally, we think Minsure should be subject to ongoing oversight by the Office of Minute Services. It's currently exempt from most provisions. Before I wrap up, I want to touch on just a few issues related to data, Minsure's data and the data that they collect. Minsure has a large amount of private data, and legislators have certainly voiced concerns at various times about the security of that data. Well, what I can tell you is that Minute officials are convinced that the security controls that have been put in place for Minsure are the best in Minnesota state government. The exchange is expected to meet federal standards for security. There have been two independent audits of security, one that happened before the exchange started, one that happened last summer. Both of those found some issues with compliance with the federal standards. Minute officials have told us that they're committed to making progress on those going forward. One of the requirements in state law is for an audit trail, so that if there's any question about who has accessed information on individuals in the Minsure system, Minsure can find out who has accessed that data. Minsure does have an audit trail. They can individually look up who has accessed a person's information. What they don't have, and what they intended to have originally, was some way to look at that across the full range of the enrollment system and everybody who has enrolled. They can't do that on a very large scale. They have to do more of what we would think of as individual lookups. And finally, we observe that Mincher really has a wealth of information that it has collected through its enrollment system. It's very hard to get data out of that system. And that's a problem for Mincher. It can be a problem when legislators have questions. It certainly was a problem that we had to overcome in the course of doing this evaluation. And so among the tasks for Mincher, we think they should find better ways for them to access the information that they keep. So overall, I want to state again, we focus largely on the first year, but our conclusion is that Mincher overpromised and it underperformed. A lot of people, consumers, health plans, counties, other state departments, had to put up with a system that did not work as expected, and it sometimes meant consumers who didn't get insurance when they needed it, and it sometimes meant a lot of hard work for some people that weren't expecting to do that much work on this system. And Mincher faces continuing challenges. It's got to be financially viable. It needs a better user experience. As Mr. Noble said, it needs to correctly determine eligibility for public programs. Ultimately, Mincher has got to execute better and be held accountable for that performance. Mr. Chair, I'll end there and see if there are questions for us.
Thank you, Mr. Alter. And the legislative auditor has any concluding remarks before we go into questions?
No, Mr. Chairman, we'd like to take your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Nobles. We do appreciate that. And I think it would probably be appropriate if we had Mr. Leitz come down. I think there's questions that will likely address him, and also Commissioner Jessen. And it might make most sense if we just had room for all at that time. I had one just initially to begin with for Mr. Alter. Just kind of looking back, we have had, all of us members have had constituents complaining about losing their insurance and trying to gain access to insurance through Mincher, through the site, the nightmares that you detailed in trying to sign up, and also trying to, in after the fact, go back and try to figure out how to fix this thing in real time. And it's been a real nightmare for Minnesotans, and also for counties, for hospitals, for folks trying to take care of them. We've seen that unfold. One of the things that you brought up was a critical moment in time, which was the go live date. And you had said that there was considerable pressure to go live on a certain date, even if maybe states weren't ready. Yet, I think there was warning signs that this thing was not ready for prime time. It was not ready to go, and yet we were pushed to go live, obviously, before this was ready. And you said that there was very little, I think the words you used were very, very little or no alternative to that. But as I look in the report on page 34, it details other states that actually did get an extension that said to the feds, hey, we're not ready to go. We need more time, and we're given more time. Was there any communication to the governor or to the administration from Mincher that said we are not ready to go, or what was the state of affairs at the go-live date?
Mr. Chair, you're correct. There were some states that intended to build state-based exchanges. There were two states that did not, at least did not, as of October 1st, 2013, go live with a state-based exchange. As we talked to federal officials, what they said to us was those states were well behind Minnesota in terms of the progress that they were making on their state-based exchanges, and that it was apparent quite a few months in advance that they were, regardless of how hard they worked, going to get to the finish line. And so I think it was a case where they, months in advance, made a decision that was not the right thing to do for them. I think in the case of Minnesota, and some of it was probably wishful thinking, there were certainly a lot of challenges that had already been faced by the beginning of 2013. But I think exchange officials tried to put a good face on kind of how things were going, where things were at, even though there were certainly kind of problems swirling all around. Our impression is that, as we said, there were others in Minnesota state government who probably should have been in the loop about those risks and challenges, but were not, including the Minsure Board, the governor. I mean, our impression is that many people were truly surprised as we got to literally weeks in advance of the go-live date and learned of some of the serious challenges that were still unresolved. And so, again, our conclusion is that exchange officials could have been and should have been more forthcoming. That's not to say that we might have still had to go forward with a state-based exchange. Oregon had a system that was completely unfunctional. Its online system just never worked. But they had a state-based exchange the first year, and they did everything manually. So there were some options. They weren't always good options.
Thank you. I think we're going to go to member questions at this time. And if you could, if members have questions, just let us know, and we'll get you on the list. And also, please direct the question to whom you'd like to answer it. We'll start off with Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the testimony and for the comprehensive nature of your report. You know, my question, probably you covered it a little bit already on your slide number 25. You know, does the current composition of the Minsure Board have the right skills and expertise to oversee this project moving forward? And the reason for my question, a number of states have canceled their exchanges. I believe Massachusetts, I think Oregon has too, and I can't remember the other one. But the point being this, when we have over 90% of our enrollees being in public programs and less than 10% private insurance or commercial insurance, the commercial insurance is supposed to pay for the ongoing operation of Minsure. The result is that's not happening. And what we see going forward is, as we've grown the expansion of medical assistance, our budget is being exploded with the cost, our state budget, $1.4 billion this biennium, $1.3 billion next. This biennium, it's about a 17% growth. We got about $500 million left to meet the needs of the rest of the state. So I don't see how it's possible that this thing can, Minsure can go forward without massive amounts of general fund money to prop it up from year to year. And I think other states have seen this and decided not to do an estate exchange or to cancel their current exchange. Do you see these similar problems with the ongoing operation? And do you think we should put more good money after bad or cut bait and fish someplace else?
Representative Grunhagen, to whom would you like to?
Mr. Nobles first and then Mr. Lights.
All right. Mr. Nobles.
Mr. Chairman, there's a lot in that question. First is, can Minsure be made to function better? And I think that's an absolute minimum in terms of the customer experience, to attract more people to use it for buying commercial insurance, and that is certainly part of the question about its financial viability. But certainly on the eligibility determination, this committee has heard from the Office of the Legislative Auditor a number of times on the importance of that. That is something we absolutely have to achieve. It's something we've been trying to achieve for over 10 years. As I mentioned, we tried it with Health Match, that failed, and then Minsure was going to make it happen, and it isn't there yet. We absolutely have to have a system that will make determinations accurately. You cannot tell people who should be in a program that they're not when you've made a mistake, or you allow people into public programs and receive public benefits when they're ineligible. And we did a report and issued it in November that showed that we do not now have with Minsure what we consider to be a fully reliable eligibility determination system. So There are many challenges. I think our report makes us more aware of those, both here at the legislature and I hope at the board. And I think it is going to take a change, certainly in the governance structure that Mr. Alter talked about, and that is who is in control of the system. Not necessarily the agency, but the system which Minsher built. As you just pointed out, and certainly Commissioner Jessen probably should comment on this, her department is very reliant now on Minsher, and the design, the vision was that she could, and that department could rely on Minsher to determine eligibility. So that has got to happen, and we think it will happen better if you clearly delineate in law that this is not just a system that is governed by Minsher, the agency, but also has to be accountable and overseen by Minute, and the Commissioner of Human Services has to have very clear legislatively established authority to help set priorities on going forward.
Thank you, Mr. Nobles. Mr. Lights, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Scott Lights. I'm the CEO at Minsher. Representative Grunhagen, to your question, I want us to step back briefly and talk for a second about the work that the auditor's office did here. First of all, I want to thank Auditor Nobles and Joel Alter and his team for the work that was done here. It was a very good audit, and we appreciated the professionalism his staff showed throughout the course of the audit. And many of the issues that I think surfaced during the course of the audit are ones that I joined the organization in December of last year, sort of partway through the rollout. And there are a lot of the issues that I saw, frankly, when I joined the organization, some of the challenges that were occurring in terms of the consumer side of things. And so we've really spent this first year, this past year, learning from those lessons that I think were highlighted in the report and applying them towards the open enrollment period that started in November and actually just ended this Sunday. And I think what consumers found this year was a dramatically improved customer experience, both from the technology side as well as from the call center side of being able to get through and their phones calls answered, even at the busiest of times, on average in less than 5 minutes. And so we really made some dramatic improvements in those areas. And what we'll know in the coming days is more specificity on the number of people who actually came through and enrolled during that period. We know that the traffic was very busy on Saturday and Sunday as we ramped up towards meeting our targets. Specifically to your question about sustainability, it's obviously a very important question, and it's one that we're taking very seriously about ensuring that the budget that we set, which, by the way, is now about 20% lower than it was when the original fiscal notes on this were done, because we've had to make some adjustments along the way, and I think intend to do that if the numbers don't support it. What we'll likely see is, as we get numbers in, we'll look at three things. We'll look at the number of people who have enrolled in qualified health plans. We'll look at the premium level at which they enrolled, since that's an important factor in how much revenue comes in. And then over the course of the year, what we also monitor and will continue to monitor is how long people remain enrolled. Are they enrolled for a full year, or do they drop off at some point, since that also affects member months, which play into it. And those will all be things that we'll continue to monitor moving forward.
Thank you, Mr. Light. Next up, we have Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Alter, this is a review of the first year of Minsher, is that correct? Mm-hmm. Thank you. And it is good, I always think, for us to do an evaluation. Part of the nursing process is always including an evaluation, and I think it's useful for us to do that. And I'm also glad to know by just reading the paper and paying attention to news that things at Minsher have improved in the last year, the second year. Which I know is not reflected in your report, but I think should be a part of the record. I also want to know a little more, if you could share with us the efforts on the part of the auditor to interview the first CEO of Minsher.
Mr. Nobles.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy and members, initially, when we first started this about a year ago, and frankly we started doing some work on Minsher before we knew we were going to do this particular evaluation, but I knew that Minsher was so important that we needed to take an early effort to at least gather information from key people. And so I personally conducted a number of interviews. We also sent some written interrogatories to all of those key people. They included the chairman of the board, Mr. Buettner, the commissioner of human services, Jessen, and a number of other people. And all of them responded except the former executive director of Minsure. She refused to respond to the written interrogatories. I was contacted by her attorney. He said that she would participate and respond if we paid her. I thought that would have been inappropriate. A certain amount of time went by, and we then were into the evaluation, and I felt it was important and necessary that we, frankly, out of fairness, if no other reason, give her an opportunity to come in for an interview. And so I sent her a letter. She did not respond. I sent her another letter with a subpoena, and then heard from her attorney. He again said that she would not respond unless we agreed to pay her and him. I again refused to do that. I did not seek a court order because she no longer lives in the state of Minnesota, and I felt that a protracted legal battle to try to bring her back under a court order was not something that I really was interested in doing. So she continued to refuse to participate and cooperate.
Thank you, and Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Nobles. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nobles, do you remember when the former executive director was separated from her position?
Mr. Nobles.
I have a friend here to help me. December the 17th, 2013.
And Mr. Chair, and Mr.
Representative
Nobles,
Murphy.
Was that during the open enrollment period, the first open enrollment period?
Yes, it was.
And Mr. Chair and Mr. Nobles, I recall that open enrollment period and feeling a great deal of frustration. I was not an early supporter of the idea of an insurance exchange when it was introduced by Governor Pawlenty in 2008, but I recognize why it was important that we proceed with this, because there were so many people in the small business and individual market that were going without insurance. And so while it took 2 years, or I guess 3 years, as Mr. Alter said, to get the statutory authority to put an exchange in place in Minnesota, and I recognize that it gave the former executive director a great challenge to try and put an exchange in place in such a short amount of time, that we weren't informed of the problems before they existed until the open enrollment period began, was of great concern to me, and really not a reflection of the kind of work that we expect from Minnesotans. And I'm disappointed that she did not come back. I know that she left, or I'm assuming she left when she left under a lot of pressure, likely public pressure. And I do think that is a reflection of the kind of accountability that we expect in our state government. And I am really glad to see the progress that's been made, Mr. Leitz, in the year or more that you have been there. I just have one more question, and it's for Mr. Buettner, if I could, Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you. Mr. Buettner, in the report, there is a mention of some of the successes. So there was a mention of the current rate of uninsured in Minnesota, and also a mention of a 28%, I'm trying to find this slide, I marked it, oh, slide 15, 28% of commercial enrollees through Minsure were previously uninsured. I'm assuming that those are people that came through Minsure and enrolled not into a public program, but instead into Minsure itself. Can you just expound on that for me a little bit?
Mr. Buettner.
Sure. Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, I appreciate the question, because the 28% number, I'd have to ask Joel where what the basis of that number is. I do take a little issue with some of the things that we've seen in the report regarding the failures as it weighs against the achievements. The report, and as any good audit, I've spent my entire career in the private sector reading audit reports and reporting on audit reports to the various boards of directors, it should detail the history, and it should detail the things that we've gone through. I would also expect, if we're going to make a value judgment about failures versus achievements, that we should document some of those achievements, as you started to lay out, the hundreds of thousands of people who did come through Minsure, and I know the report touches on some of the consumer satisfaction that those folks saw, as well as the balancing some of those individual costs of and individual benefits of somebody getting into coverage for the first time. I don't know if anybody has done a formal assessment or whether DHS does that of people moving into public programs, but just on a pure gut basis, I find it likely that many people who are moving into medical assistance or Minnesota care are not coming from places where they've had substantial insurance, and so you know, I do see some significant benefits, and I'd like that to be that the analysis of those achievements factored in when we talk about the overall look at the program, and you can certainly see some of those changes into the second year as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say that I am glad that we're holding this hearing today. I think it's important, and I hope that there is a chance in the future for us to talk about the current state of MNsure and the successes and experiences that have been gained from the first year of its existence. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. And Mr. Buettner, just to clarify that Representative Murphy's question, that was about 28%. Is that 28% of the 55,000? And according to my math, that would be for all of the entirety of MNsure and all of the work and all of the time, that would be a net increase of 15,000 people. Would that be about correct?
Mr. Chair, I think your math is in the ballpark there. That's right. We're looking only at the commercial insurees, 28% of about 55,000.
So
that, according to our survey, had not previously had insurance.
Sure. So most of those people are on public programs. Maybe they were on Minnesota Care and now they are on Medicaid, or maybe they're on one public program to another. But of all of the dollars that were spent to try to work on the uninsured in the state of Minnesota, all of the people who lost insurance and then tried to get it back, some 140,000, we've only insured 15,000 new people.
Mr. Chair, I guess I would add that there are also people who may have been uninsured who went on to the public programs that aren't reflected in that number. This is only looking at the commercial side of the equation.
Thank you. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nobles, this is the third report that you briefed us on in terms of the concerns that we've shared about MNsure. And in light of this being the third report, I'm just wondering if you could share for the committee members whether or not you believe that the problems identified in the subsequent reports or previous reports and the audits, have the responses been timely, and do you think that the responses have been substantive based upon the items that you've detailed in your earlier reports?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Albright, members, I have some concerns, frankly. Have had over my experience with MNsure about the forthrightness and willingness of MNsure to step up and take responsibility and acknowledge some of the problems that have existed. I think that for me started when, you may recall, there was a data breach at MNsure, and MNsure's response to that was to fire the person and say that was the end of the issue, that there was no systemic problem at MNsure. We conducted an investigation and issued a report that found that the person who was immediately responsible for that data breach made an honest mistake. She pushed the wrong button on her computer. But the real story of responsibility for that data breach rested with management, who had made numerous decisions that caused that data breach to occur. And I never heard management take responsibility or accountability for their part of that data breach.
Mr. Chair.
So I guess, Representative Albright, I just think, you know, yes, there have been achievements. Yes, there have been enrollments. There's been just an awful lot of pain and anguish out there on the part of the customers who've tried to use MNsure. Yes, it may be getting better. But I would reflect, too, on the chairman's point that we have spent an enormous amount of money to create Minsure, and certainly members of this joint committee know how precious dollars are in human services. There are many needs out there among people in nursing homes and the disabled and in a lot of other ways, and the amount of money that we spend here could go a long way towards addressing some of those needs. The state decided to spend that money on creating this exchange, and it's been a lot of money and a lot of promises made, and I think it is absolutely fair to hold Minsure accountable for what was promised and accountable for the amount of money that has been spent. So that's why I appreciate this hearing and others that are going to occur.
Thank you, Mr. Nobles. And Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question actually is for Mr. Nobles, Mr. Leitz, and Ms. Jessen. And I'm going to draw your attention to page 69 of the OLA report, where it talks about the enrollment. And at the top of the header, basically, in a nutshell, says that the enrollment was a flawed underestimate of the MA enrollment. And then I just want to draw down to a couple of points that I find just shocking. DHS said that its projection was an error. It did not include all of the new MA cases DHS intended to include. Further down, it says DHS enrolled 23,170 new people in MA, nearly twice as many as it projected for all of Minsure's first open enrollment period. DHS said it noticed its error in the spring of 2014. Minsure's total enrollment goal of 135,153 was never revised. Minsure continued to use the original projection as a benchmark for its enrollment success. And then the last sentence on that page, those projections envisioned a large-scale eligibility redetermination and conversion of hundreds of thousands of existing public program enrollees from DHS's existing enrollment systems to Minsure. So for those people that I've identified, I'm at a loss for trying to appreciate upon what basis those projections were first initiated, whether it be through Gruber Gorman or through the model that was provided by that entity and through that contract to your desks. But why would there not have been a concerted effort to reevaluate the model and to reassert your responsibility to put on paper and to assert for the basis of the people that were going to fund this the right numbers? Mr.
Commissioner
Chair.
Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, the enrollment error was a DHS that was used in setting the target was a DHS error. We acknowledge that. I take responsibility for that. I would like, and that was an error that was, you know, made, I think, sometime in 2013. I just would like to point out that while this was an error in the number that was given to Minsure for their enrollment target purposes, you know, that was not an error that was in our budget, that was in our budget forecast. That if you actually look at eligibility in public programs overall across all of those our different platforms, including Minsure, that we are very much on track with the budget forecast for DHS, but it was certainly an error in giving that number to Minsure.
Representative Albright.
Mr. Leitz, I'd like you to respond to that, and then if Mr. Nobles would comment on the findings in his report. Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think the projections that were done back in October, I believe, for the board, I think, if I recall correctly, were ones that were presented to the board of directors, I think, in mid-October. Those were the projections when I joined the organization in December that I was aware of and that we sort of measured up against. I don't know that we there was a lot of things going on at the time in terms of sort of trying to fix the technology side of this. and from my perspective, really focused on ensuring that we were enrolling as many folks as we possibly could during that time period. And so I think, you know, I think findings like this are important, that the legislative auditor raised them, and I think this is going to be important for us moving forward to make sure that when we do projections, they're well documented and that we have the numbers as accurate as possible.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Albright, I really don't think I have anything more to add. I think our finding speaks for itself, and there's an acknowledgement that there was an error, and it needs to be corrected.
Thank you, Mr. Nobles. Next up, we have Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Nobles, and your staff for a lot of work on an area that was moving fast and having to make a lot of decisions on the fly and stumbled, as you've well documented in many places. But I just want to bring us back to the overall, at least what my vision was, and I think a lot of the discussion was, and that the whole reason for doing any of this was to reduce the number of uninsured in Minnesota and across the country, because we know that we all pay in our insurance rates for the uncompensated care that gets shifted onto the people who have insurance. Our small businesses have complained about insurance rates going up, and medical bankruptcy continues to be a major cause of just total disruption in too many households' lives. And so in spite of the well-documented computer failures, and there are many, the outcomes for Minnesotans that you document here are pretty impressive to me. And I don't think we've spent enough time kind of highlighting that, because it's just so much fun to talk about what went wrong as we were doing things. But I just want to call attention to the fact that you mentioned that three-fourths of the users reported reduced insurance costs. I mean, that to me was a major success in terms of bringing down the cost of insurance. But what I was really surprised by, and this wasn't mentioned, but it's on page 65, is that in almost all areas of the state, the amount of low to moderate income households who were uninsured were cut by over half. And that's a pretty uniform outcome across the state, with a couple of outliers. And you know, that's something that ever since Minnesota Care was created, I don't know, decades ago, has been a goal to try and get the working poor and moderate income people whose employers don't offer insurance to have an option that's affordable. And I noticed that throughout the report you compared us to other states and how they were tripping or succeeding and those sorts of things, but I didn't catch, although I was just kind of quick skimming through this, to see how did we do on this performance metric. Did we do better than other states, better than the federal government in terms of reducing these uninsured numbers? Do you have any sense of that?
Mr. Alter.
Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler, we really don't have any state-by-state comparison of impacts on the uninsured. And I would point out one thing on that table on page 65 that you're looking at. What we're doing there is comparing the number of people who enrolled in MnSure. And this is anybody who enrolled, not necessarily people who were previously uninsured. We're comparing that number to the number of uninsured in that region. So it's just a way to try to use the number of uninsured as kind of a metric, a way of measuring how MnSure did. It does, again, it doesn't mean that all those people who enrolled through MnSure in that region were previously uninsured. I just wanted to clarify that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Alter, and I really appreciate that. And the other thing that intrigued me is I wasn't sure who was going to be kind of taking up in the private insurance market, because that's not something this committee tends to deal with. And it, if I'm interpreting your numbers right, of those who were previously uninsured but now bought a commercial product, 29% were uninsured for over 5 years, and 23% were 2 to 5 years uninsured. So this did get to those people who were long-term without health coverage. It appeared like not just in the public programs, but in the private market as well. Is that a correct interpretation?
Mr. Alter.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, I think the data that you're alluding to of kind of the profile of the people who were previously uninsured, who enrolled in commercial insurance through MnSure, is correct. That what we found, and I think it was a bit surprising, was that many of those people were kind of long-term uninsured, people who had been uninsured for 2 years or more. I think in some other studies that we had seen, a lot of times you weren't getting that population as much. So again, I think that's an interesting thing. Again, that's based on survey data. We'll see over time if that continues to prove true. But I thought it was interesting that of those people who were uninsured, we were reaching some of the people who had been uninsured for a long time.
Thank you, Mr. Alter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just one other question. Since the computer system was a mess to start with, it was didn't have enough time and had other issues, and the call center was initially understaffed, given that we achieved such, I think, impressive numbers in terms of new people with insurance who never had it before or hadn't had it for some period of time, can we attribute this to the navigators and the outreach efforts of MNsure, do you think, as a major contributor to that success?
Mr. Alter.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, again, I think on the issue of why have we seen a reduction in the number of uninsured, I think there's still a lot of unanswered questions. I know that the Department of Health will be doing larger scale surveys that will probably shed more light on this. But as I said earlier, I mean, what's unclear at this point is how much of this was because we expanded our Medicaid program, how much was because we had navigators and brokers and MNsure kind of beating the bushes to try to get people to enroll, and how much was because we had a federal mandate for people to have insurance. I mean, any of those factors, all of those factors probably played some role, and it's hard to know at this point exactly what role.
Thank you, Mr. Alter. We'll go to Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nobles, Mr. Alter, thank you so much for the work that you've put in and the time that you've put in on this audit. I think we have Minnesotans all across the state that are kind of asking those questions of what went wrong and where could Minnesota have done a better job. And I think Mr. Alter ended his comments pretty succinctly in saying that MNsure overpromised and underdelivered. I would add, as an aside, that it also, while overpromising and consistently underdelivering, it left Minnesotans all across the state holding the bag, and counties, all 87, holding the bag for the failures of MNsure. And so, as we look back and say it was a computer problem, we didn't have enough operators. No, it was a programmatic, systemic failure. And the better and the quicker we realize that here in St. Paul, the quicker we can actually get to fixing the problem. But to sit around and say, well, we insured 15,000 new people for nearly $200 million. That's crazy talk. So, I'm sorry, that's craziness. As I've been talking with the folks at Sherburne County, one of the concerns that they have moving forward is that they're at a worse place off now than before we had MNsure. They're doing everything by paper. I talked to Anoka County, and they're enrolling people by paper, because the back end of this system is broken. Mr. Lights, what is the status for getting this up and running so that the basic functions that could be done from 20 years ago till 2 years ago can be done tomorrow for our counties? Because right now, they're scrambling, they've had to hire a ton of people, and they're filling stuff out by paper, and we're $200 million in. How do we get out of this mess?
Commissioner Lights.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zerwax, so I'll answer it in a couple of different ways just to kind of give you a little background. I would say that this year was highly focused on improving the customer side of this. So what we saw during open enrollment period this year, I think, was dramatically different than I think what the OLA accurately described in year one. But that did mean delaying some of the issues that the counties and, frankly, the health plans and some others are partners in a lot of the enrollment. And it includes the agents and the brokers and the navigators as well. The issues that would make their lives a lot better are ones that, to date, we haven't been able to fully address. I can tell you this. This coming year, 2015, near universal focus we have on the build-out is very much to address those issues. There's no question the counties are frustrated. They have every right to be frustrated, and we would not say anything differently. They've been enormously good partners. They have really been patient during this process, and that's why we've really consciously worked to create a process by which their input and their participation, direct participation in the priority setting, is now something that we have. That was missing before, and frankly, it was a mistake not to have had it. So where we stand is that's very much where the focus is going to be for this coming year, and we look forward to making lives for a lot of folks a lot easier.
Representative Zerwas.
Mr. Leitz, are you prepared to give a date certain when qualifying life events and other basic county function can be addressed and can be fixed for our counties? Because I'm talking to individuals in my area that, I mean, they're just befuddled as to how this could be so screwed up when, as the auditor's report addresses, you know, pre-Mincher, this was a 5-minute keystroke, and now it's an hour and a half ordeal if someone on a public program does something wild, like gets married or has a baby or gets divorced. I mean, we're not talking once a month things. We're talking every single day. They're stumbling over the roadblocks put in place by this system. When can you give us a date certain when these issues will be addressed?
Mr. Leitz.
Mr. Chair, Representative, what we'll be doing over the course of the planning process is ongoing right now, but where we actually will be triggering will be in the coming weeks, the beginning of the programming of those pieces. I'm not going to be able to give you a specific date simply because I'd get it wrong probably most likely, and I don't want to give you that without doing it. What I can tell you, though, is that we consider the issue of like life event changes, for example, county worker portals so that they can make those changes directly, to be of the utmost priority. And when you look at our priority list that's been jointly developed with the counties and with the Department of Human Services and MNCHR, it absolutely is at the top of the priority list because those are critical things that need to be in place.
Thank you. Representative Maury.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I think Mr. Alder is the one that actually got into the details, and I've just got anecdotal info, but you had there's two questions. The first one is, as to 3/4 said their premiums were reduced. Now, I've talked to my constituents, may not be typical, but maybe they are. Probably 100 or a little less, but they said first a number of them said that it wasn't reduced, but then after they looked, after I asked them to go back and look at the credits that they get, every one of them said that they actually received a reduction. So when you're using 3/4, is that, are you sure that they've all checked their credit when reporting that way or not?
Mr. Alter.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mullery, all I can tell you is the group that we surveyed, and this is based on a representative random sample of people who surveyed in commercial insurance through MNCHR. So these are people who had a successful enough experience that they actually did come away with insurance. And just looking at pages 93 and 95, and we asked different questions of them. And on the question of what benefits did you experience from MNCHR, it was 43% who said that their health insurance costs were lowered as a result of MnSure 26%. Their health insurance costs went up. And on the on page 95, we specifically asked about premiums. 48% said that that their, and these were people who had insurance previously, 48% said their premiums were better than they were before, lower than they were before. 32% said they were higher. So, I mean, it was a mixed picture. It was more good news than bad news. And this was, again, a representative random sample. Maybe in future years we'll see different patterns, but that's what we heard.
Okay, and one other question, Mr.
Representative Maury.
They also, the ones that talked to me also said they liked their new plan better, and they thought they got better insurance. Did you do any study on that directly?
Mr. Alter.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mullery, again on page 95, partly what we're asking about in the exhibit that's shown there are, for people who had insurance previously, what aspects of the coverage do they think was better, the same, or worse? And I think one of the things that's interesting is people weren't as happy with the out-of-pocket costs under MnSure. You see, of the categories where people said this was worse, that was the one that was the highest there. Whereas premiums is where people tended to say, yeah, that's better than it was before. So, and you can see on coverage, about half the people said their coverage was the same under MnSure as it had been before. So that exhibit gives you kind of a breakdown of different components of insurance and how people thought MnSure compared to what they had before.
Mr. Chairman, if I might just add, though, to this discussion, I think going forward we're going to have to also factor in and do a follow-up on the impact of Preferred One pulling out, because, you know, there certainly were a number of people that could buy that product and achieve the benefits that you mentioned, and that is no longer available, at least from that particular provider.
Thank you, Mr. Nobles. And just a follow-up to that, did you look at folks who tried to sign up through MnSure? Maybe they lost their insurance because of changes in the law. They went on MnSure. They weren't happy because they couldn't conclude it. Then they went outside of the market and purchased insurance to figure out if their costs went up or down, or what their experience was outside of the MnSure market?
Mr. Chair, we did not. I mean, this, we were focused. We had hoped to actually include in another survey people who had set up an account through MnSure but didn't enroll. That didn't happen because it was difficult to get data on those individuals. So we focused largely on the people who, in fact, were insured through MnSure.
Thank you, Mr. Alter. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to put this all a little bit in context. I think that's really important. First of all, the thank you very much for doing the audit. I think it's very important. It was very important that that was part of the law to get this audit done. And we have to remember now that we're looking back at that first rollout period and not today. And I realize there are still some challenges today, but this is all looking back and saying, what could we have done better? It's important to remember what we were coming from. And I don't want that to get lost. Not only that there were 28% of the people who signed up for a qualified health plan who were uninsured, but what was the situation that existed at the time that this was started? And what would there be if we hadn't done any of this? What would the alternative have done? Because this isn't like we could have something perfect, but we had something perfect before, and now look at, oh, we're so bad, we've got a flawed program. That's not the situation. So if everybody remembers, we're coming out of a situation where a lot of people couldn't even buy insurance. They could not buy it. They would be rejected for pre-existing conditions. And even if they didn't have that now, they worried that in the future they'd never be able to buy insurance. Now people can buy insurance. Very important. People can stay on their, children can stay on their parents' plans until they're 26. Big advance. Help to bring down insurance, help to make bring down the uninsured rate, and help to make sure that young people can get started in a job that maybe doesn't supply them with insurance. So we've made huge advances in the state and in the country. there was some talk, you know, a lot of talk about how broken this all was. Well, it's born out of a broken political process, and let's not forget that, because this could have been put in place, and there could have been two additional years for Minshew to get started before this all had to happen, and yet we had leadership here in the legislature that basically refused to move a bill. So, and what was the alternative? If no bill had been moved, we would have been in the federal exchange, and there were certainly a lot of problems there. And we still see Republicans in the U.S. Congress voting over and over and over to repeal the Affordable Care Act without any replacement. So if we're going to just knock Minshew, and I know there are problems, and I do appreciate you bringing those problems to us, but what is the alternative? Is the alternative, let's create something perfect? Well, nobody knows what that is or how to get there. So the question that I have for you, I think for Mr. Alter or Mr. Nobles, or, you know, the money that was spent on the exchange, you know, that's being put forward as though, by some anyway, as though that's just wasted money. And yet we now today have an exchange that's more functional, still not perfect, still has a lot of challenges, but we're moving forward. So I'm thinking that perhaps, although maybe we spent more than we should have on things that didn't work, that we're moving forward, we're getting more experience, and things are improving, even if not fast enough. Things are improving, and it looks like, whether it's in another year or 2 years or what, that Minnesota's going to have a pretty darn functional system. So I want to ask you, am I misunderstanding that, or did we take all of this money and just throw it out the window and now it didn't do us any good? Can you put that in context for us? Am I misreading this, or are we now at least seemingly on a path to being able to provide Minnesotans with something that will eventually work well for them?
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Nobles,
Representative Liebling, well, we do have Minshew. We have a Minshew system. It has some level of functionality. And certainly I think we all hope that it will improve. I think everybody at this table, especially Mr. Leitz, hopes that happens and is going to work hard to make it happen. But I do think, having, you know, been at the Legislative Auditor's Office for a long time, and coming into that office as an evaluator, I think it's always appropriate to do an evaluation in the context of cost and benefits. And so I think we have to take into consideration the amount of money that was spent. I can only say again, as I think we all will agree, it's a sizable amount of money. And for that, we do have a system. Were there alternative approaches? You referenced the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, which did a number of good policy things, I think we would all admit. But the concept that the implementation of the ACA required government, and specifically the state of Minnesota, to get into the online shopping business, I think is a different question. You know, but we decided to do that. And we engaged in an enormous advertising campaign that certainly, as I think we would all agree, created the expectation and the promise that it was going to be a customer-friendly experience, and it simply wasn't. And so that's what our report is about, that we ultimately did not deliver to the people of the state the kind of customer experience that we promised. And we did not, and I always have to come back to this issue, we did not achieve what ultimately we must achieve, and that is a fully functional, fully reliable eligibility determination. Otherwise, we continue to have the risk that some people will be denied eligibility that should be determined to be eligible. Some people will continue to be put in the wrong programs. Or we may continue to deem some people eligible who are not. So there's a lot in there. I just think, frankly, speaking just as a state employee, I think we should have done better. I think that, you know, that frankly, those who supported the development of the ACA and the decision to create a Minnesota exchange of all people deserved better performance than they got.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Nobles, I think everybody in this room agrees that we should have done better. I think we've known that for a long time. I don't think we needed your report to tell us that, frankly. And I appreciate that it lays things out in detail. But I think we all know that it should have done better. But I'd like to address this to Commissioner Jessen, because I understood that part of the reason that we chose to do an exchange here in Minnesota was because we also needed some serious investment in some of DHS's technology to do what we were already doing, to do the eligibility, and certainly also on the county side, and we still need a lot of that investment. But I thought part of the idea and part of the reason that we were going in this direction was so that we could kind of get a twofer here and try to upgrade and integrate that system at the same time. And so I think it might be a bit misleading to just look at this as being just Minsher and all this money being just Minsher and, oh my gosh, it didn't go the way we wanted, and to kind of not look at the bigger picture. And I realize, Mr. Nobles, your charge was a narrow one, but our charge is a more broad one, and that is to look at where we are and how we can use it to move forward. So I'd like, if she would, for Commissioner Jessen to address that in terms of the money that was spent and what we may or may not have received at this point.
Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, thank you for the opportunity to talk about this. I mean, one of the reasons I believe that the legislature made the decision to go forward and build their own state-based exchange was to really leverage the federal funding, those kind of 90% matches, to build a human services IT system that we desperately needed. You know, I think many of you all know that our old legacy systems are beyond repair, and we have to replace them moving forward. And we saw this as the opportunity to do that, starting with healthcare, but really to have an IT infrastructure that then we could say, okay, let's also make this the infrastructure that someone can go on and find out if they're eligible for SNAP, for our cash programs. And this is a new IT system that the counties and DHS desperately need. And that's why we desperately need to get this right. And I appreciate very much the OLA's review of that first year. As someone who lived through it, I think their overall assessment is correct. I think we have made progress since then, and we have a lot more progress we need to make. But Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, also think that this point is why I particularly appreciated the OLA's comments on the need for more involvement of DHS and the counties in governance of the IT system. Because this is an IT system that we look at. It's one, it's mostly the vast majority of it, over 90% of enrollees going through this will be public program enrollees, and over 90% of the funding come from public programs as projected. But even more critically, if this is the platform for improving and having a new integrated eligibility decision for DHS and the counties, we believe that we should have an overarching role in that governance structure, that it should be clearly in place. And so I just wanted to highlight that recommendation, and thank you all for making it.
Thank you, Chairman.
Can I just comment on this? I think it's a very important point.
Mr. Nobles.
I have said this to many of you privately. I'll say it here. I mean, one of the most important things you did when you created Minsher and with a board, and you can talk about and debate whether or not having a board is a good idea or a bad idea, but the one good thing for sure you did was that you put the Commissioner of Human Services on the board. For the very reasons that you point out, Representative Liebling, this was a lot about trying to modernize a very antiquated eligibility determination system. And we recognized that that was part of the vision. That was maybe one of the most important things in the vision of creating Minsher and the system. And that's why, you know, in November, we issued this audit report, and why I've emphasized in my comments today that we didn't achieve what we need in that vision. because we still do not have a fully functioning, fully reliable eligibility determination at Minshew. So, I mean, I realize there are all kinds of issues about the commercial product, but if you just want to focus on what we tried to do on the public side in eligibility determination, I think that's great, because that is a serious, serious need that has not been met.
Thank you, Mr. Nobles. And Commissioner, just to follow on that, we had an experience in Minnesota with a program called Health Match, which was a gigantic failure that tried to do exactly what we're trying to do within these public program eligibility requirements. And it was very expensive, it took a long time, and it flopped. Much of the criticism for the rollout of this is the audacity of trying to impose this gigantic IT project in such a short period of time. What do you think about the people who say that we should have known that this would not work because we had such an utterly disastrous experience with Health Match, and here we go again? That's what we've heard from a lot of the folks trying to implement this.
Mr. Chair, let me address a couple of those things. Health Match was before my time as commissioner, but I certainly heard about it. I think one thing that was different was with some of the simplification that the federal government through the ACAA imposed, the fact that they're not asset tests and some of those things made it a little more, though very challenging, possible to do this IT project. But Mr. Chair, when you talk about the short period of time, I think that is that was seriously the challenge here. I see Commissioner Tom Baden sitting there, and I remember him, who's commissioner, our new commissioner, Minute. I remember Tom telling me, over a year ago, he said, "Cindy, this was should have been a 3-year IT project, and it went live when we were like barely maybe at the end of year one." So I think that. While it is a major undertaking, I do think that we're making progress and it is doable. We desperately, for the reasons Mr. Noble said, need to get this right, but it is going to take some additional time.
Thank you. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I do have a series of questions. However, if you want to cut me off, I fully understand. But first, before I get into that, Representative Liebling, you know what, our charge is very broad. And I would say that every single person around this table wants to do the right thing. Every single one of us. It's difficult to either support anything that is put before us, defend it, explain it, or assist in making it better if, as pointed out on page 53, when key information is being withheld from the decision makers. And so that would be my first question, is why did that take place, and how are we going to prevent that in the future to where we can actually make this a better product? And then I have a series of questions.
Thank you, Representative Hamilton. I assume that is to the commissioner?
Actually, I would like to hear from either the CEO or the chairman.
Mr. Lights.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton, so I'll start on this. I'll ask Chair Buettner to follow up. And I will ask clarification from Mr. Nobles. I think what the report refers to in that area of transparency and information exchange was really in the run-up to the go-live of the exchange in October of 2013. And I can't speak directly to that because I was not with the organization at the time. What I can tell you is this. When I was asked to come and take over at the exchange and become the CEO, I promised several things. The top thing that I promised the organization and the people of Minnesota was that I was going to run a transparent organization that was going to provide information to the legislature, to my board, and to the public as we had it, good, bad, or otherwise, because I think it's important for Minnesotans to have that information. I think we've largely succeeded in doing that. I'll ask others, I guess we'll have to be the judge of whether we've succeeded in being a transparent organization, but it has been my goal, and one I've tried very, very, very hard to succeed on, is making sure that people have the right information so that they're making decisions at the right time. I can't necessarily speak for the past because I wasn't there, but I can speak for the future and what's occurred on my watch over the course of the last year, and I think we've tried to create a very transparent organization.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to follow up, absolutely no good would come out of withholding any information. I think we all understand that because we are all in this thing together. And by providing that information, we can make this even better. I think my next question, will Mr. Chairman go to the CEO or the chair again, is the problems in the report that have been raised in this report. Number one, have they been completely fixed? Do you have a report that you can provide for us? And if they have not been fixed, what is the timeline to get them completely fixed? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Light.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hamilton, I would say that, as I said earlier, many of the issues that were referenced within the report that occurred in the rollout during the October to March period are ones that we've identified and largely have either addressed or are in the process of addressing. There are certain ones, though, that relate to the line of questioning earlier that relate to some functionalities that the report doesn't necessarily touch on, but that need to be in place for the system to be fully functional, that we need to continue to work out, and those will be developed over the course of the next year. I think that as we go into the summer and the fall of this year. So I would say that with regards to the report, I would have to probably tick through each of the issues, but I would say as a general statement, most of the issues identified as problems during the roll have largely been addressed. There are likely some that will still need some work. I think the issues related to the data systems in particular are ones that we need to continue to work on. I think as the system, though, continues to get more stable and builds itself out over the course of the year, that's one I'm confident that we'll be able to address as well.
So, Mr.
Representative
Chairman,
Hamilton.
Just clarifying then, are you telling me that the problems that have not been fixed, the timeline is by the end of this year that they will be completely fixed?
Mr. Light.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton, our goal would be over the course of the next, as we run up to open enrollment for the QH, for the qualified health plans, and throughout the year for public programs since they can enroll throughout the year. So I think what I'm saying is basically our 2015 focus is to continue to, A, build out additional functionality and address any of the remaining issues that are in the auditor's report.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I may, on the enrollee piece, you're talking about fixing that problem. Are you guaranteeing that this is not going to happen moving forward, the issues around enrollees?
Mr. Lights.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton, just a clarifying question. Are you talking about the consumers as they're coming through and challenges that they have in getting enrolled? That's what you're referring to.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And making sure that we are getting the correct people, the ones that are actually eligible, enrolled.
Mr.
Chair, Representative Hamilton, that certainly is an extremely high focus. I can tell you that, as Commissioner Justin, I think, has previously testified to, the system for making eligibility determinations is one that has dramatically stabilized and improved over the course of the last year. It's very, very important, as Auditor Nobles points out, for us to get that right, and that's one that we place a great deal of emphasis on and importance on. So we absolutely are going to be focusing very heavily on ensuring that that's the case.
Mr. Chairman, I do have two more questions, but I can wait for a while if you have others on the
okay,
list.
Okay, why don't we bounce back, if that's okay,
yes.
with you and Representative Hamilton, and go to Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The comment was made earlier that we have a flawed political system, and I guess no one in this room would disagree with that. We do have, though, one of the greatest democracies in the history of the civilized world. So let's not beat us up too much. But it stems actually from the federal government, where it's flawed, and I'll tell you why. In the OLA's report on page 2 of the summary, it shows and says that because of the federal government's trickling down information as to how states can formulate and put their exchanges together, they did it in such a truncated manner that it didn't give the state an opportunity to put together an exchange that was well thought out and efficient. Now, Representative Liebling, you said, you know, you blamed actually someone that leadership didn't put together a bill that would formulate the ACA. But I'll show to you that we had 28 amendments for House File 5 on exchange that we offered that fixed some of the glitches. Now, it didn't fix everything because nobody has a crystal ball, but they were brought to us from leadership and from experts in the field, insurance agents, insurance providers, doctors, hospitals. And constituents, yes. Thank you, Mary. So some of the fixes that we thought that would be good to prevent some of this from happening, and they were completely ignored. And unfortunately, that's a sign of the times. We're a nation that's politically divided. And I think we all have to get over it. And we are a little sore, yes. We don't want to say we told you so and point fingers. That does no good to anyone. But we'd be foolish not to say something because we were a little upset that none of our suggestions and amendments that would fix some of the glitches would even taken on. So with that said, Mr. Lights, and appreciate your taking the helm. This ship is maybe steering, will steer with the help of Jim Noble's office and your leadership and Commissioner Jessen's office, steer to the right direction and help the people. The question that I have for you, and I have just a couple, one for you, I think, Mr. Lights, and one for Mr. Nobles, and that is, what are your projections going forward for enrollment for 2015? And I'll preface that with, I noticed that the board announced an $89 million budget, operating budget. It's a lot of money. I know you recognize that. Maybe that number's inaccurate. If it is, please correct me. How is that going to be justified with the numbers that you anticipate to enroll in 2015?
Mr. Lights.
Mr. Chair and Representative McDonald, so a couple things. What we projected for QHP enrollment for the open enrollment period and essentially throughout the year for MNsure in 2015 is about 67,000. So that's what the budget plan is currently based on. I'll mention that I think what we're actually anticipating for expenditures is around $43 million. So I just wanted to sort of correct up the record a little bit on that piece of it. Open enrollment, as you know, it just ended on Sunday. So we're in the process of finalizing numbers. We hope to have those out in the next day or so so that we'll be able to get information out. So the budget is basically based on that level of enrollment, and we'll have to get a little bit more information around what the premium level was, because that also goes into that estimate as well. We'll have to compare what the actual premiums were that were sold in the market versus what the projections held. And then we'll have a sense of where we're at relative to our budget plan. We have a requirement under state law to submit a budget to the legislature by March 15th. And so based on the numbers that came in February 15th, we'll get a little bit of information on the premium side. We'll be working with the board over the course of the next month to finalize that so that we're able to get that to you all.
Thank you, Mr. Lights. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Glad to hear that the budget is now down to, what did you say, 69 million?
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, I think we're anticipating, based on fiscal, this is a fiscal 2017 budget of around $44 million, since that's the first year where we're fully stable as an organization.
Representative
Mr.
McDonald.
Chair, thank you. Good, because they did unveil an $89 million budget, correct? Was I accurate in that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Donald, we have done some revisions. So the number I was giving you is sort of the number of over which the point at which time federal funds are no longer available. The 89, likely, I don't have it sitting in front of me, likely is the revised number based on the fact that we did receive some additional federal funding.
Mr. Chair.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Chairman. Mr. Lights, then, should those projections not come to fruition, the 67,000, what safety nets, if you will, do you have in plan to accommodate that?
Mr. Lights.
Mr. Chair and Representative McDonald, that'll be work that we'll have to do with our board should that not materialize. Obviously, what we'll be looking at there is where can we make expenditure reductions or trimming to the budget that will still allow us to have a robust exchange, but we'll need to re-examine the expenditure levels and see where there are opportunities.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Thank you. And then lastly, Mr. Lights, I appreciate the work that you're doing, and fully recognize, I think we all do, it's a daunting task. We all appreciate the transparency, and I know you to be a man of great transparency, and we'll bring that. That leads to me to the last question then, and I'll let other members ask. For Mr. Nobles, in your finding, one of your recommendations, you offer a suggestion that the legislature should consider having the board, an advisory board, more so than a governing board. Now, that was the governor's recommendation, if I'm not mistaken, or one of the recommendations. Remember, the governor had a task force that was put together. They worked hard. They spent time and money and resources, and then they presented their findings, and none of them were taken into an account or implemented in the exchange.
Mr. Nobles.
So should we, or you say should we, make an advisory? Would you recommend that we strongly recommend we make them an advisory board?
Mr. Chairman, members, we didn't make the recommendation in the report, and so I'll let it stand the way we characterized it there. I think the more important issue, frankly, and the first step that needs to be taken, and that is the issue of accountability for the CEO, the head of Minsure. We believe, as recommend, that that be a gubernatorial appointee. There was talk a little bit ago about the fact that there was not an exchange of information from the management of Minsure when things were really not going well. And there was a lack of transparency, a lack of communication from the then CEO to the board, to the governor's office, to the legislature, and a lot of other people. We think that that could be improved by a direct line of accountability and responsibility to the governor. We did interview the governor as a part of this evaluation, and we did discuss with him what he knew and from whom did he get that information. And it was, frankly, troubling to us that it certainly seemed that the governor was not well informed by the then CEO about the risks and hazards of going live on October 1. And I think that's probably true of others as well.
Thank you. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate the opportunity. First, before I start my question, there's one thing that kind of triggered in my mind when I was hearing the comments about the law when it was approved is, from my recollection, there were at least 13 amendments that went on to the original bill from the Republican side that we did have that became part of this bill. I remember that Representative Qualm had an A25 amendment, Representative Mack had several amendments, even Representative Grunhagen's one of his amendments was even approved on the final bill. So it was a bill that did have some bipartisanship and did have interest coming from both sides as we put it together. I think that some of the things that we've been seeing has been more, what I seem to pick up strongly through here is that we tried to put together a product that seemed really rushed, and a lot of it was coming off the IT side. And one of the questions that I have, and I was having trouble picking it out in the report here, and this might be to Mr. Nobles to try to answer for me, is we had a private vendor that we were working with as we're trying to put the system together. And to me, it's very confusing what was going on in the initial rollout. Were people being properly held accountable? Things were changing back and forth. Could you summarize that a little bit better for me to get a real understanding as what failed in that part of the process? And are there corrections that have been taken to address that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Fisher, members, you know, every major systems development project that the state of Minnesota and, frankly, most other organizations in the private sector and public sector involve a relationship with vendors. And, frankly, I think one of the most challenging problems that we've had consistently is ensuring that we are getting, that we're adequately managing those vendors and that they are delivering what we are paying them to deliver. That was, in fact, a big part of the failure of HealthMath. A very protracted, very acrimonious relationship with a vendor that finally ended in a lawsuit and a lot of other problems, and getting nothing in the end in terms of a product. We also, as you probably know, just pulled the plug on a relationship that we had with HP to develop Minlars. And again, a very protracted period of time in which we let that relationship go on until Minute, the commissioner of the Minute Services, said, we're not continuing in this relationship with you. And so I think that was one of the issues that we had and raised about the fact that the legislature in the legislation exempted Minsure from the oversight of Minute. And there was, frankly, a serious battle over that, both within the executive branch and here at the legislature, and I think it was, frankly, a very silly, unnecessary battle that was basically a turf battle with the commissioner, then director of Minsure, wanting everybody else to stay out of her business. And it was very foolish, frankly, that she didn't embrace and welcome the experts in state government to help her build this system. I've never understood that sort of attitude. But I will say, you sanctioned it in the law. So I think some of the culpability is here, as well as within the executive branch. I do think you absolutely need to repeal that exemption. It has de facto been repealed. And Minsure, under the new leadership, is really embracing the help of Minute. And I might say, I don't want to go on here too long, that as you all know, the new head of Minute is Tom Baden. He was heavily involved in the development of Minsure, worked probably as hard or harder than anybody else involved in the development of that system to make it a success. And he would be the first to admit. And we interviewed him, and he said it in the record to us. If he were up here, he'd probably say it to you, that in spite of all of the hard work, that they did fall short. And some of it was in the complexity of managing the relationship with the vendor and the lack of performance on the part of the vendor. But I will never give up the responsibility that the state has to manage vendors adequately and get the delivery of service or pull the plug. And, you know, that sometimes, unfortunately, really happens too late.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Nobles. I appreciate the work that you folks have put into putting this all together. It raises a question for me, too, as you were explaining the problems on that side. I see the reference, and I've heard it also from Commissioner Jensen, that this was a project that should have taken several years, and instead we've combined it down to a very short time frame. And from what I was hearing before, I was hearing that this should have taken 3 years to roll out in terms of making sure we have the system tested and that'll work. And what I'm seeing now, we're still well within that three-year period, and yet I'm still hearing that we're having things promised to us. Are we looking at realistic time frames here? In other words, are we starting to set ourselves up for a fall saying we're going to have things done by X time, and we're still pushing the time frame on it?
Well, I think, Mr. Chairman, Representative Fisher, that's a very good point. The time frame was too short, and I think one of the most serious consequences was, and everybody recognizes this, there was not an opportunity to do the kind of testing that should have been done. And ultimately, we tested Minsure on the public, and not with a good experience, and we're still continuing to do that. You know, once you go live, it's hard to then turn it off and say, well, you know, we're going to do some repairs and get it up to functionality that it should have. So it's a little bit like we're continuing to put together the airplane while it's up in the air. But that's the reality we're in.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Nobles. A couple of other questions I have is, as we're going forward, one of the things I notice is that the shop section, would I be correct to assume that is something that is fallen by the wayside and we just haven't had the time to have come back in, and will that be coming in the future?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fisher, I think it's fair to say that in the development of the system, there was, at least this year, a fairly conscious focus on making sure that individuals, people buying individual coverage, had a much smoother, better experience, and we consciously did make a prioritization decision. I think it was the right one to do that. And what that's meant is that certain functionalities, particularly shop is one of them, are not as robust, I think, as they could be and possibly can't and will need to be. I think one of the things we have seen, though, is that marketplace is not developing as rapidly as I think almost any state expected. Looking around the country, and when I talk to my colleagues around the country in other states, small businesses, I think, have tended to be fairly sticky in the coverage that they have and have stayed largely outside of the shops. There were tax credits initially, but those will be expiring. And we did not see the level of enrollment, I think, that some had predicted we might see in those. I don't know how large that marketplace ultimately will be. And so that'll be a piece that I think moving forward we'll need to look at. But I think that from a prioritization perspective, we really did focus more heavily on the consumer side. I think it's a good question. I think some discussions with the board around how prominent do we want CHOP to be moving forward will be things that I think we'll need to have some discussions about moving forward.
Thank you. And we'll go to Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It sounds like we had problems with our IT vendors. And when I think when they see a lot of money, they may overpromise what they can do for Rensselaer in the state. How have you changed the contracts with vendors? Is there now a financial penalty if they don't make a deadline? Or have you changed any of the, how we contract with vendors to make sure we're getting a good product that works in a timely manner?
Mr. Chair and Representative Schultz, I'm going to start answering that question. I'm going to ask Mike Turpin, who's our general counsel, to also come down and maybe join at the table just to answer more specifically some of the things that we've done to change that. I would say, so a couple things. The first and most important, quite frankly, thing that we've done is to establish, and the auditor's report talks a little bit about this, a much, much clearer governance structure for the IT build itself. And what that means is, I think when you, if you had looked at this issue a year ago, year and a half ago, what you would have seen is there were needs that the qualified health plan side of the shop needed, there were needs that DHS needed on Medicaid. I mean, it was kind of somewhere in the middle of the mix there, but it wasn't really clear who was sort of the point person on things. And what we have really consciously worked on over the course of the last several months is, leading into the spring, I should say, is really putting in place a very clear governance process where Minute, in its role as the technology experts, works as the point directly with the vendors. So now the vendors know who it is that they're directly dealing with. They're the Minute's the experts. They know this stuff better than I ever possibly could as a, as an organizational CEO. I have other duties. But we have we're represented on Minsure on the business side, and DHS also is represented on the business side. And we sort of feed our prioritized needs up to Minute. Minute works with the vendors. And then in terms of, like, the vendor contracting, we have made changes to how it's done. I'll ask Mike Turpin, who's the general counsel at Minsure, to talk a little bit about how we've evolved those contracts.
Mr. Turpin, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and your title for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, Mike Turpin, general counsel for Minsure. Yes, I think going along those lines, I think in pivoting forward on the contract structure, I think one of the major differences was historically going into the project, there was essentially a large-scale fixed-price contract, one where you had a set of vendors involved in that contract. It was really a main contractor, and it was very specific deliverables with a specific time period, and it was very fixed. I think one of the important pieces that is laid out well in the audit report is some of the changes that occurred over time, both in federal rules that came in over time that really required the project to pivot and make changes. And so it really doesn't lend itself well to a fixed price contract where you have a very defined scope and defined set of deliverables if ultimately you're having to pivot at each point. The current structure allows, with the governance structure, allows for the business to really set those priorities and then is pivoted to vendor contracts that really allow for more nimble movement to really direct services where needed rather than being tied to a scope that was drafted in a time period, in 2011 or 2012 when the realities of what are needed are really day-to-day and understanding in those what are the most important things, what understanding better what the cost of those will be, and then being able on the business side to really work those out and deliver resources as necessary. So that's really the structure that we pivoted to, is to be able to have that type of direct relationship with each vendor and then allow the business through the executive steering committee and the established governance structure and the project management to make decisions about the allocation and use of resources.
Thank you, Mr. Turpin.
One more question.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going forward, I know sounds like the legislature, we need to do something to improve Minsure to make it work for all Minnesotans. And I'm just hoping that we can get guidance from you. Right now, there are several bills being introduced in both the House and the Senate on the governance structure. But I would really like to meet with Scott Leitz and Commissioner Justin and other stakeholders, the board, to figure out what you need to function in the best manner for Minnesota. So it'd be great if we can have those conversations to do the right thing to move forward in and improve Minsure and stop attacking it. Because I believe this definitely can be a bipartisan effort to improve Minsure and work on what we have. I mean, people forget that health exchanges, this was a conservative idea from the Heritage Foundation based on market systems. So if we can go from there and improve it and make it work, that would be great.
Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I still find it very, very fascinating that three 20-year-olds built a website, I think it was last fall or was it 2013? Anyway, three 20-year-olds built a website to help people get health insurance under the ACA in about 3 days. The cost was about a few hundred dollars to do this, and you can actually go on there. It's healthsherpa.com, and put in your information, and bam, got a policy. Here we are in Minnesota and all over the nation still trying to figure out with millions of dollars how to get this to operate. Fascinating. Couple of questions. First question, and I'm not sure, I think Commissioner Jessen, perhaps I'll address this to you. You know, as when I was had children, I have three children, you know, one of the things, you know, not only trying to find childcare, but all that good stuff, but when you get out of the hospital, the last thing that you want to do is contact your health insurance company and enroll that child. It's one of those things that you sometimes can space doing, but it has to be done. So I'm just questioning how many newborn babies are uninsured due to DHS and Minsure being unable to modify the qualifying life events, and how is the backlog currently for this? It's one of the questions that I get from new parents calling me saying, is our child even covered? Is my medical bills going to be covered?
Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Franzen, adding a baby is something that we have sent instructions to the counties. County workers are able to do that now. It takes, as I think was said earlier, this is taking more time, and we want to work to make the time that takes county workers to make those additions less. And that's, I think, one of the things we need to work on in the system. But you can, they can be added. Certainly, if they're not added quickly enough and they're on MA, you can get retroactive coverage, and we'll work with families on that. You know, I would say, Mr. Chair, Representative Franzen, that that certainly at the department, I think like the counties, we are concerned about the ability to make life changes. You know, being able to add a baby was some of the first instructions we were able to get and make sure that that was a real priority. You know, the addresses or income changes and to be able to make those in a quicker way is a real priority, and that's why we are heartened that Minsure is making that a real priority this year. And it is also, I would say, Mr. Chair, Representative Franzen, one of the reasons why we have delayed, as Mr. Noble's report points out, transitioning the hundreds of thousands of people off of our legacy systems into the new system until we're able to have that greater functionality to be able to make life changes.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Okay, well, thank you, Commissioner Jessen. If you could just keep us posted on that. And it's not just with the qualifying life events of a newborn, but any increase or decrease in income as well creates quite a backlog. I have a question for Representative Lights, I believe. So reading the report, it was highlighted that four groups received $400,000 together as grant dollars, and only 175 people were enrolled with Minsure. When I do the math, that breaks down to about $2,286 per enrollee, which is a pretty astronomical amount of money per person. So I'm wondering, why weren't the outreach grants audited last year? what progress has been made in implementing an audit system, and for fun, how many outreach grant participants actually met the enrollment goals last year? There's got to be some positive news in this somewhere.
Mr. Lights.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yeah, I think the audit that Auditor Nobles and Mr. Alter talk about here with regards to some of the first year of the rollout of the Navigator programs, I think we learned a lot of lessons watching that first year. Quite honestly, it was a program that was very important. I think it's been very successful in helping folks get enrolled broadly, because I think word has gotten out because of some of those activities. But I also think that we learned that there needed to be one, I think, a much tighter focus on accountability within those grants and watching how they were originally structured back, you know, in the fall of 2013. And so when we rolled out our Navigator program or our grantee program for this year, we focused on much more heavily on accountability of ensuring that goals were met along the way and that we were paying for those goals to be met. I think that's a really important point here, that we want to make sure we're getting the outcomes that we expect for the dollars that are being spent in those areas. We also focused it very heavily differently this year around ensuring that we knew, we did a much better job of looking at where do we know where the uninsured populations are, where do they exist, and then how can we focus our grants on organizations that work much more on the ground with those organs, with those uninsured populations. Some of that happens to be in urban areas of Minneapolis and St. Paul. Some of it happens to be in greater Minnesota. We'll be very happy to provide you and the committee with numbers with regards to sort of where the enrollments are once we get sort of that tallied through the open enrollment period. Very happy to do that. I don't have them at my fingertips, but very happy to do that.
Thank you. Representative Franson.
Thank you.
Last question.
Last question, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Lights, will MNsure attempt to recover outreach grants funds from organizations that didn't meet their enrollment goals? Like I said previously, it was $2,286 per enrollee on that 175. I mean, I imagine there's just got to be some money that is sitting there with these grant recipients, right? Because they couldn't have personally, really seriously spent the taxpayer dollars in such a high amount. So are you going to claw back some of those, you know, going forward?
Commissioner Lights.
Mr. Chair and Representative, we will obviously be working with all the grantees to look at whether they met their goals, how well they did relative to those goals. I think it's important to keep in mind that we're sort of in year two of doing this. We learned a lot from year one, and the estimates that they gave us around how many folks they have enrolled sometimes were realistic, sometimes were wildly unrealistic. And we worked very hard to get them to be much more focused this year on getting us realistic estimates of what we thought could actually get enrolled under there. I think that we are not certain exactly how we'll play out some of the pieces that you're asking about with regards to, you know, meeting goals and what that means for targets and so forth. That said, I think that we will be very closely monitoring those organizations, and if we're not feeling that we're in a good spot relative to what they're doing on the outreach side and what enrollment is coming through, we certainly will take the actions necessary to ensure that we're wise about spending those dollars.
Thank you. Representative Lohmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, everyone, for being there. I really appreciate the report from Mr. Nobles and Mr. Alder, and appreciate you all being here today, and I know we're talking a lot about costs here, but I think that was one of the things I heard loudest and clearest in the report, was that we spent an awful lot of money and we really haven't gotten what we paid for. So I guess my question is, just currently, between the federal funds and the state, how much money is being spent on the MNsure system this year? That's probably for Mr. Lights.
Mr. Lights.
Mr. Chair, I think the numbers that are reported in the auditor's report was around $155 million total that had been spent. Now, we do have some additional new funds that have come in from the federal government, around $34 million or so. So it's probably, just doing the math in my head, in the 190-ish range, something like that.
Representative Lohmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I just guess my second question is, moving forward, what types and amounts of funds are going to be available, like loans, carryovers, that type of thing?
Mr. Lights.
Mr. Chair, the money that has been given to us to establish the exchange under the establishment grants that were given to us by the federal government, the last round that we received would require those funds to be spent during calendar year 2015.
Thank you. And Mr. Lights, just to follow up on that, the allocation through the tax that was that has gone up to 3.5%. Our committee was told that it wasn't likely to go that high. In fact, did go that high. You have accessed through the requests and received additional funds from the federal government for this year, and accessing those dollars. Also have access to through MMB a line of credit or monies from MMB. Do you anticipate accessing any other lines of credit or anything other than what is currently on paper for MNsure this year, and if so, how do you see moving forward with those monies?
Mr. Chair, I'm just making sure I'm checking through everything in my head here. I'm not anticipating anything additional beyond what you've already laid out as sources of revenue for the exchange.
And so, Mr. Lights, do you anticipate or have you budgeted accessing lines of credit or borrowing money?
Mr. Chair, no, not beyond kind of what's already, what there's already authority.
What you've been given authority to get?
Yes, Mr.
Chair. So should we anticipate that you will expend all those funds?
Mr. Chair, I'm not able to answer that question right now because I just don't know the specific answer to that question. My sense is that we're not planning to tap those funds, but I can't say that with certainty. So I want to be a little cautious in how I answer that.
Thank you. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my first comment is just on technology. I was given reason to believe that the opening was not going to be as good as we would have hoped because it was being done in such a short time frame. And at this point, I know people are still doing things manually, so it's even worse than I had anticipated, and I'm hoping we're going to do that. But I think during the meeting today, we've also brought out two other examples of technology programs that didn't work well. So at this point, I'm hoping that we can come up with some valid questions or program that whenever we go into a major program again, that we are asking the right questions. And I realize it's kind of like a moving target, but we've spent an awful lot of money, and I'm not sure we've learned what the lessons are that we've learned at that point. So I think we need to be asking questions and putting together a program. On the positive side, during the past half year or so, I'm getting more positive comments from people that have purchased the insurance. So that's a good thing. We have done a lot of good work. And even this last week, I was aware of telephone calls going in, and one was during the week, and it was to a call center in Rockford, and the woman was very, very helpful and very nice. So, I mean, waiting time is like less than 5 minutes. And even on Sunday, there were a couple calls made that, again, the waiting time, I was impressed. It was less than 5 minutes. So I know that at least people trying to get in are getting help. And that frustration, I think, is an incredible an improvement. So thank you for that.
All right. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question's for Auditor Nobles. Now, the Affordable Care Act passed in 2010, and we've heard here today that it takes about 3 years for an exchange to be established in a way that it's most successful and that people can depend on it. I first took office in 2013. I remember that we had to create an exchange that year by March of that year, or else we would have a federal exchange imposed on us. So I guess I'm just wondering if you know, while researching this for your report, if you consulted with any members of the legislature from 2011, 2012 about what was going on during those years, and why there was no effort put forward, apparently, to create an exchange.
Mr. Nobles.
Mr. Chairman, well, I think it was a policy choice by the part of people in the legislature at the time that they did not want to go forward, as many states did not. I mean, I think, as Mr. Alter pointed out, Minnesota is somewhat in the minority in its decision to create a state-based insurance exchange among the states. So, I mean, the choice that was being made by legislators at that time is the choice that has been made by many other state legislatures not to create a state-based exchange.
Thank you.
Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question would be to Commissioner Jessen. You had referenced a little bit ago about the retroactive coverage, and I was wondering if you could give us a little bit more detail on the process of that and what that meant for the last year, if it's still going on, and what kind of time and cost the department might be going in for that.
Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schumacher. So under our medical assistance program, you can get retroactive coverage back to when you applied, if the process takes a while. And so, and that's been in effect for a long time. But we've used that to really make sure that where, especially during that first year, where people struggled to get through the system, that we were able to, and maybe sometimes they had to go to a paper application, that we were able to go back if they incurred expenses, after they tried to apply, but they had a hard time getting through online, or it took a while to process the paper application, that they would get coverage back retroactively back to that date when they first applied. So that is, I think, one of the good things about our medical assistance program is that we were able to do that and help people in a broad way, even for those who did struggle, especially during that first year. But it certainly is additional work both for employees at DHS and the counties.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Schumacher.
Commissioner, do you have any estimates on what kind of time and costs there might have been associated with that?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schumacher, I will go back to the department and ask about if we have estimates. I know it's something that it was more time-consuming sometimes than others. As I think the report reflects, there were much more struggles in the first year. We've made improvements since then. And we also have been starting to look at how, and I'm not sure exactly where we are in this process, have more of that retroactive coverage be not have to be as much of a manual process as it did earlier. But we'll be happy to share details with you and all members on that.
Okay, and one final question, Mr.
Representative Schumacher.
Last month there were a series of cases where public assistance applicants got locked out of the system, and I was just wondering what the status was with that, and maybe it's more for Mr. Lights.
Mr. Lights.
Not sure about that one.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schumacher, maybe I'm just not understanding exactly what you're asking about, the people locked out of the...
The public assistance application.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schumacher, I'm happy to find out more details about exactly, or I can look at Deputy Commissioner Chuck Johnson, who's nodding his head. So I'm not sure exactly what you're referring to. I certainly know that for any of our public program enrollees, if they have problems getting through the online system, they're able to put in a paper application and get retroactive coverage back to the date they submit that paper application. But I'll ask and let you know if I learn something.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. And we've reached the end of the questions for the first round through. We do really appreciate the you're spending so much time with us, and we have some secondary questions. If we have a few more minutes left, if it wouldn't be too much to ask, if people haven't asked a question, we'd like to get to that. We certainly understand that. But also, if you would mind just maintaining with us until 3:30, we have a few more questions, and also, as you can see, there's a lot of interest within this. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Noble, I know you've been here a lot longer than me, but when I very first came in, and I started thinking how, if you're here a while, things go around. there's so much gnashing of teeth today from certain people about what sounds to me, compared to what was going on when I first came in, here there's this, it seems to me, and maybe you can, if I'm wrong, say so, this seems really complicated and something that 3 or 4 years had to be put together in 1 year. When I first came in, there was a, it seemed to me really simple, just a personnel data system for the state that just, we had control of everybody. It was all within the state. Here you're dealing with all kinds of individuals in Minnesota. You're dealing with counties, insurance companies, everybody, the federal government. And but there was a system that actually, as I recall the numbers, cost us a lot more, you know, especially in inflation dollars, that system, and it had started, I believe, at the very beginning of Governor Carlson's 8 years. It seemed like there were those problems over 8 years for a much simpler system. So if you compare these, it's, am I completely wrong by saying that it seems like we're spending actually less money on a much more complicated system that had to get put together really quick?
Mr. Chairman, members, there is no doubt that this is one of the most complicated systems the state has ever tried to build. But we knew that. And we knew that building these systems is complicated and there are risks and they take time. And yet, I mean, the decision was made with eyes wide open to proceed. That, I mean, the legislature, the executive branch, knew what the date was on the calendar, and they knew what the date was for go live. And they decided to go ahead and build a system and go live. Those were all conscious decisions that were made by people. And this is the result. In terms of the dollars, I'd have to go back and look at some of the budgets of some of those earlier systems. I frankly don't recall, and you know, we would have to do the inflation adjustment, that any of those systems cost an amount approaching $200 million. But we can check on those numbers. But again, I just think we created the parameters for the challenge we took on. And as we know from talking to many people who were there at the time, they, some of them, not all of them, knew what some of the risks were to go live on October 1, 2013. And that decision was to go live on October 1, 2013. And that decision was made. It was a decision that was made by people. It was not an automatic requirement, but it was a decision that was made. And we are living with the results.
Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for your continued testimony and responding to those questions. Just a couple of comments before I get to my question. I think there's some skewed information and information that wasn't quite accurate shared at this committee meeting. One was that you know, premiums actually went down. Well, they didn't go down unless you had a subsidy inside of the exchange. They actually went up, and your out-of-pocket costs were more. The other thing is, prior to the ACA, you couldn't get pre-existing conditions covered. That, again, is not true. We had the MCHA plan, Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association, which covered pre-existing conditions. You know, there was a simple and inexpensive solution to reduce the number of the uninsureds in a cost-effective way and create better access than what the current system is. And, you know, it was shared numerous times in the committee that we had a 9% uninsured problem in the state of Minnesota, 9%. Well, 6% of that 9% were eligible for government programs, but they refused to sign up. So 70% of the 9% were eligible for one of our programs but didn't sign up. So all we needed to do was find a way to coerce them to sign up for the program. and you would have reduced the number of uninsureds to 3% in the state, which would have been less than the 4% we have currently after spending tens of millions of taxpayer dollars. Secondly, as far as the county and Representative Zerwas spoke to this, you know, it took them 5 minutes under the old system, 60 to 90 minutes under the new technology. You know, one of my goals was to update our for our county workers the technology. I was on a subcommittee with Representative Loeffler when our first session, and it basically took $30 to $35 million to update the county technology, and that would have given us good verifiable information on who's eligible and who's not. So we could have reduced the number of uninsureds greater than what we have now. We could have had a verifiable public system with our county, making it much easier for county workers. And I would say we would spend probably $50 to $60 million with about $30 million ongoing. And when we look at our projected expenditure increase in medical assistance in the budget, we could have saved about $1.3 billion, which we could have spent on roads and bridges, higher ed, K-12, or given a tax cut to our businesses and families. So there was a simple, inexpensive solution. I promoted it, others did, but it was rejected. And yes, I did get one amendment on, but it didn't do hardly anything. Any substantive amendments that were offered for MNsure were rejected, not only in the first 2 years, but also last session. Which brings me to my question. You know, there's a provider on MNsure that I talked with, and they referenced the Deloitte study on the technology problems we have. They said that the Deloitte study had 30 goals that needed to be accomplished on technology as far as MNsure. They said after 1 year from the Deloitte study, one of those goals was completed, 29 were not. Chair Leitz and Commissioner Jessen, I'd like to you to respond to that Deloitte study, and is the information that I was given accurate, and why weren't the other 29 recommendations completed in this last year, or will they be in the coming year? Thank you.
Mr. Leitz.
Mr. Chair and Representative Grunhagen, we've had a couple different looks at the system. The first one we had was having Optum come in and did a pretty high-level evaluation of things, and we essentially used that as an organization as a roadmap for how we were sort of going to kind of chip away at making this thing better over the course of the year. And then one of the steps we took was to that was recommended is that we needed to have a better project management structure in place. We really brought Deloitte on to be that project management lead, working with our staff and sort of helping steer the project along. Along the way, they did an assessment as well at a little bit more granular level of the functionalities that should exist within a fully functional exchange that has all the things that are that you would like to have. And what they identified was a series of approximately 30, give or take, of items that needed to be continue to be built out. Some of the functionality already existed, so that was pieces that were already in place and were good. There were some that needed to be added to make the system functional. When we start to look towards 2015, that's the list that we'll be working off of, essentially, from a prioritization perspective, is taking that list of 30 and identifying those that are of the highest priority within that. And then those will be the ones that will be over the course of the year when we had our discussion earlier about sort of what the timing of things is going to look like. That's what we'll be working off of from a prioritization perspective are those items that were identified by Deloitte.
Thank you, Mr. Leitz. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, building on that project management and the issues, who was the focal point directing and coordinating the bug report and fix process in the, as we can probably call, failed process we had? And then now that we mentioned your revamp, who is the person coordinating that project management oversight and focal point in MNsure for the bug fix
and you know, that reporting process.
Mr. Chair and Representative Quam, I'm not sure on the. I'll answer the second part of your question first, since that's the for me the easier part because it was it's been while I've been with the organization. The process that we've put in place now, in terms of sort of having the point of who's actually doing the work with the vendors to ensure that we're getting the fixes in, either for bugs that appear or for future functionality, we've really, Minute is really playing that role now. Minute is really the technology point from a project management perspective. I think one of the challenges that we had during the rollout period, if you sort of look back, 18 months ago when this was all, or 18 months to 24 months ago, is that that structure simply was not in place the way it should have been at that time, that there wasn't that what some have described as the single ringable neck, the person that you go to do, like, make sure that something gets done. And we needed to have that in place, and that's I think, what why we've worked really hard between our agencies, Commissioner Jessen's agency, MNsure, and Commissioner Baden's Minute agency, to make sure that we have much better role clarity. So that we know that when the vendor, when there's a challenge, the vendors know it's the direction around how to fix it's becoming from Minute, and it's going to be reflective of the joint and shared priorities that my agency has and Commissioner Justin's agency has.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and having walked by a Malcolm Baldrige, award being exposed to project management systems, there's always a focal point at the end customer that makes sure that it gets done. So I heard that there is no MNsure person that's a focal point. Can you clarify and correct that to reassure us that somebody at MNsure has the buck stop there and is making sure that the IT people are implementing and that it will make the functionality milestone? And can you repeat what that functionality milestone date is?
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, yeah, let me sort of try again at this, since I probably wasn't very clear in my last answer. There's certainly, first of all, from a buck stopping perspective, obviously from the MNsure side, that's me, and from that's where that occurs. What I was trying to drive at on the technology side, I think consistent with what the auditor's report talked about, there is essentially a three-agency steering committee that's involved for my organization, MNsure, Commissioner Jessen's DHS, and Commissioner Baden's at Minute. And we've worked very hard to get to role clarity around who actually is the point that the vendors work with and take direction from to ensure that the customer needs are being met from both the citizen perspective and from the perspective of the businesses that run, whether it's Medicaid and Commissioner Jessen's agency, which I care a lot about in terms of also getting enrollment, or on the qualified health plan side from, getting tax credits to people. And then what we have done is established a process by which Minute, in its role as the technology experts for the state, are really that point person with the vendors to ensure that we're getting the customer needs met. They take our business needs and our priorities, work with the vendors to ensure that they're getting that information processed with the vendors, that the fixes are being made, and then act as a conduit of information back to us as the businesses, so that we have that structure in place to ensure business needs are being met, but that the experts in technology are really the ones dealing with the vendors to ensure that the technology pieces are getting taken care of.
Thank you, Mr. Lights. Appreciate that. Mr. Nobles, any final concluding comments before we wrap up with one last question?
Mr. Chairman, I just want to thank you for this hearing and for all the questions and the engagement that we had with the Joint Committee. We now get an opportunity to go and repeat this over in the Senate. We're due over there at 4.
Yeah. Well, you'll have good practice for that. Just one final question. This is really for the commissioner, and we have heard, from our constituents, from the counties, from all of the folks that you heard about, and the people that are included within this document, just of the nightmare that this has been for consumers trying to deal with MNsure, the site, the call center, all of this which has been publicized, but also from other Minnesotans that have struggled to find health care insurance that they can get seeing of prices going up. Really, families really, really struggling across the state. And I think what they're looking to this audit, and they're looking to us, is to say, where are you going moving forward? We're looking backward and we're saying, what should have been done and when should it have been done and who should have known that and where does the buck stop? We understand that. That's a very, very good, clear thing to say. But moving forward, there's people within Minsure who are looking at this moving forward saying, what's going to happen? There's people that are worried about getting insurance. They're saying, how am I going to get insurance? But there's also investors. Every single Minnesotan is putting money into this program. And they have not gotten the straight skinny. We heard from Gruber and Gorman how many people were going to be enrolled, and those numbers were incredibly off. And that affected the rollout. We've heard projections from inside of how many dollars this would take. Those have been incredibly off. So people are saying, justifiably so, what are we going to have to do to put in to make this system sustainable moving forward? Or in fact, should we look at what other states like Oregon have done and said, let's stop putting good money after bad? We've invested and invested and invested in this, and the numbers have never been where they need to be. So what assurances moving forward should we have to the citizens of the state of Minnesota who pay and continue to pay through this system, both in state tax dollars and federal tax dollars, that that is a good investment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me make a couple of reflections to try and answer your question, because I think that's a very fair question. I do think that, and I agree with Mr. Nobles and Mr. Alder's assessment of the first year, kind of I certainly lived through that. But I think what we have seen for consumers, most of them going through the system today, it is an improved system. It is easier to navigate. It's easier to get through. And increasingly, and I believe those eligibility decisions the system is making today are much improved over what they were even 6 months ago. But what the big challenge we have moving forward is to make sure that the system works better on the back end, for those county workers, for the health plan workers, for the things that may not be able to be immediately seen, but we need to not only make sure, like, for example, an eligibility decision is right, but that those life changes, those income changes are easily put in and the county's workers are able to manage the cases in an appropriate way. And we have to make that work not only better, not only for our system, our health care eligibility enrollment system, but also so this is a platform moving forward for a truly updated human services IT system. And I would say, Mr. Chair, that so we have seen some progress and we need to see more, and that progress is not going to happen overnight. But I would also just remind everyone that the status quo is not an option, that our, at least from a DHS perspective, our legacy IT systems, We can hardly staff them anymore. Commissioner Baden has to go get people out of retirement to be able to repair them. They are going to fail in the next few years. We have to do something. And we are in a better place now, certainly, than we were with Health Match. We are seeing some improvement, and we need to see more. And I do think that a number of the recommendations made in the auditor's report will help us get there. And we owe it to the citizens of Minnesota to do just that.
Thank you, Commissioner, and thank you, Auditor, for your good work, and Mr. Leitz, for coming today. We really do appreciate all your time. Members of the Health and Human Services Policy Committee will reconvene in 5 minutes. And members, we are adjourned. Thank you.
Good afternoon. We do have a quorum present, so I'll call the Health and Human Services Reform Committee to order. And our first order of business will be to approve the minutes. Would someone be willing to move the minutes for February 11th? By Representative Backer has moved to approve the minutes. Any discussion? Oh, Representative Mason.
I have a question on my notes. I had Dave Renner and Amar Hughes that were also at that meeting, but they're not on our list. Is that right?
Mark Cusack. No. I didn't have anything.
Representative Mason, can you clarify exactly where you mean?
Okay, it looks like, according to my notes, during that last bill, House File 377,
mm-hmm.
I have a Dave Renner who was representing the Minnesota Medical Association. I had a Mark Hughes who was talking about, I think he said he was a Shriner, and he supported the bill.
Any further discussion? Oh, he's here?
He just left after
class. Oh, shoot.
But he was at that.
Well, we can make the amendment to add those two testifiers to the bill. So any other further discussion on amending the bill? Or, amending the minutes, as Representative Mason suggested? And all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you. And then we will move on to what I call deja vu. House file.
You're asleep. You're awake.
Good afternoon. Okay. Representative Kresha is here again to present House File 8, which is regarding updating child protection provisions. Representative Kresha, welcome back to the committee, and I move that House File 8 be sent to the General Register. Representative Kresha, if you could please present your bill to the committee.
And thank you, Madam Chair. I believe we need to take up the amendment first. Okay. There's an author's amendment. So I'm not sure, with your motion, just to make sure we get this right, you've moved the bill, and I believe you need to move the amendment.
All right, Representative Kresha, I'll move the amendment as presented.
Thank you. And thank you, Madam Chair. And so what you have in front of you is the DE 2 amendment, and this will get the bill in the shape that I'd like for the committee. What we are trying to accomplish, just so you know, this bill has come through in a similar form with House File 191, and the Senate, that bill, by the way, is moving, has moved through civil law, public safety, is going to HHS finance, but the Senate has had a little bit more difficulty in moving that bill, and they're going to judiciary. So in talking to Senator Kathy Sharon, who's the Senate complement, the idea was, let's see if we can do what we can do right away to make an impact. And there's two things that we think we can move without any financial impact, but also will make a difference. One of those is you'll find in lines 1.10 to 1.14, and that is to be consistent with the task force recommendation of making sure that children's safety is paramount in statute. And the second piece is to repeal, and this is on line 2.28 and 2.29, to repeal the provision that was passed in the last legislature allowing for screened-in reports to now be used for historicals. So we're taking this out that a screened-out report must not be used for any other purpose of making an offer of social services, therefore allowing County Protective Services to look at past history of screened-out reports. It's an immediate change, and it will allow them to go and look at those historicals. So that's all we're doing at this point, and moving the effective date to the day after the final enactment. And I would ask your support on the amendment.
Any questions? Director Liebling, or excuse me, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so, Representative Kresha, if I'm understanding here what you're doing with the delete all amendment is you're just taking a piece out of this other bill and trying to move it forward because, as you say, it doesn't cost anything. That's what I understood. But as I'm looking at this, I mean, I have no problem with anything that you're doing here. I mean, I agree with these pieces. However, I guess I would say that I think this will have costs. I mean, just because there's no appropriation attached to it, I would guess that the counties in particular would probably say, I mean, mainly the piece on the first page, you know, changing the focus. I guess I would be really surprised if they said that there's no cost. I mean, I guess my question to you is, are you mm-hmm. sure that there isn't any cost? Has the appropriate people looked at this to tell you that this is a piece that can be moved without any cost?
Representative Kresha.
And thank you, Representative Liebling, for that question. Yes, we have looked at this. And again, all we're doing at this point is removing the provision that families are best served by interventions, that language, and replacing with that children are the paramount safety. So all this is really doing is just laying out in statute that we want to put children first. I realize it's a bit of a technicality, but that's all that's doing. How the county social workers decide to change their practices, that's for them to decide, but the mandate here is put children first. And so if there's a cost to asking children to be first, we have not heard that.
Okay. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Krisha. I appreciate that. And the other question I had is the part that we also passed last session had to do with keeping reports and that counties were told not to throw them away. I mean, it seems a little contradictory, but we did do that too. That piece is still in here someplace, right?
Representative Krisha.
Yes, and so the provision is that counties have to keep the reports for 1 year. The larger bill, 191, actually is going, we're trying to move that to 5 years. So yes, that piece is still in there and very important.
Okay. Representative Liebling, thank you. Any further questions? All right, seeing none, Representative Krisha, do you have any other testifiers here, or is there anybody from the public that would like to testify on this bill?
And Madam Chair, if I could, I do not have any other testifiers. I believe we have to move the amendment first that hasn't been approved.
Okay.
Then we can get to the bill, and then I'd love to go to the House floor.
Okay, sounds good. So then I will also bring forward that, pardon? Let's move the amendment first.
Yep.
So we've moved the amendment, I believe, and so all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. So now we have the bill in the form that you would like it.
Thank you.
And would you like to follow up on any other comments on this bill?
I do not, and if I could, I'd yield to Representative Mullery, who's been a big part of this as well.
Representative Mullery.
Madam Chair and Representative Krisha, I think you're aware about how a lot of members of the task force feel about what's going on. Basically, we had a task force set up to look at a serious, at least three seriouses, problem, and basically the line 228 and 29 wasn't even in effect when that was going on, and so taking it out just puts it the way it was before, and basically I've talked to some members of the task force about this. They're extremely disappointed that the legislature is not going to do anything about this serious problem. And so I'm not going to interfere with Representative Krisha's bill, but I think it's unfortunate that we can't get something through the legislature that really does something on the problem, and it's not mine or Representative Krisha's fault.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Zerwas.
Madam Chair, I guess a question for the author, because following up on Representative Mullery's comments, I guess, that's a pretty concerning take. I mean, we've, as a legislature as a whole, and certainly as the committee that both of you have been serving on, have identified this as a very significant issue, and one that can't be solved with one bill or maybe even two bills, but requires a lot of work. And so we had spoken earlier, and I just want to make sure, Representative Krisha, that this is step one of a multi-step process, that your other bill with the financial implications is still on its way to Chair Dean's committee, and the follow-up recommendations when you bring the band back together with your task force, that there'll be subsequent bills. This isn't it, is it, Representative Krisha?
Representative Krisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Zerwas. No, the party is still going. So if I could, and members, if you allow me to indulge for just a moment, because this is a very important issue, and as Representative Mullery stated, we cannot celebrate this as the victory. This is not the victory. This is the starting point. And I will be honest, this is going to take a lot of political will from both sides to move this. There are issues in this bill that span data privacy, law enforcement, and there are lots of folks that rightfully so want to have conversations about this, and I can tell you that the political will to move this in a fashion that's going to make a significant change for our children and child protection is going to take all of us, and I hope that you're going to come on board with that, and I think many of you will. The House File 191 that will be going to HHS Finance with Representative Dean is another larger step. But on March 31st, we're going to get the full recommendations of the task force. And in talking to DHS and some other interested parties, there will be a bill coming out of that which will take some further steps. And I can tell you all of these are very important, and they're going to take some time. Every step along the way, somebody out there is challenging the status quo, sometimes for good reasons. I never want to throw anybody under the bus. But I will just tell you, when you get into the area of families, protecting children, and those opportunities, there's many sensitive conversations and many, many, many steps. And so this is one step to try to keep us moving and not to let the momentum die. So thank you, Representative Zerwas. You're right on, and I will be ringing the bell as loud and clear as I can, inviting people to join the bus.
Any further discussion? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Kreisch, I almost was going to say the same thing as Representative Zerwas when I heard that comment, because I really appreciate the work that's been done on this and the dedication that people have shown. And I'm really glad to hear what you're telling us today, because I really think we need to do something about this and not, you know, not let it fall under the bus in some way or not happen because of lack of the will to put funds toward it. So I'm with you on that. I'm not surprised that there's a little bit of that it's not as smooth sailing as it first seemed like it was going to be. I was even a little surprised because I think it's with big issues like this, it's not as though there is a perfect way to do things if only everyone would just agree to them. You know, there really isn't a perfect way, and we've seen, like, kind of historically with this, that the pendulum kind of swings back and forth on how these things are handled. And certainly we want to use all the experience and everybody in the task force and bringing together all that different expertise to try to find the best policies. I think that's a wonderful way to do this. But, you know, let's just all be really clear that even if we all say, great, you know, here are the changes we need to make, let's all hold hands, jump off the cliff together and do them, we'll never 100% solve this problem, because, you know, it's just not a, it's not a problem that lends itself to one sort of solution. And so, you know, I just commend you for taking this up and wrestling with this, and, you know, and for everybody who's trying to find some compromise so we can move forward in some way. But, boy, we'll just let none of us think that we're really going to 100% solve the problem, because I'm sure that whatever solution we end up with is going to, there'll be some unintended consequences of that, too. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thank you, Representative Liebling. And I would just say, if the celebration is that the governor's signing, we've done it wrong. If the celebration is when we see a reduced number of life-threatening cases and deaths, then we've done it right.
Any further discussion? All right. I will renew my motion that House File 8, as amended, is sent to the General Register. And all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed say no. Motion prevails. Thank you very much. And
thank you, members.
Thank you, Representative Kreisch. And just a reminder that our meeting tomorrow is from 2:45 to 4:30, and the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.